It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. Great panel for you. Michael Nunez joins us from Popular Science. Serenity Caldwell from iMore. Jason Heyer from Tech Republic. They're back from CES. They've got the latest, the greatest, and the silliest CES tech gadgets. We'll also talk about the future of Twitter and Facebook and a whole lot more. A big TWiT coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 544, recorded Sunday, January 10th, 2016. Up all night to get lucky. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price. Because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/twit and using the promo code TWIT. And by Harry's. Stop overpaying for a great shave and start the new year off right. Go to harrys.com and get $5 off your first purchase by using the offer code TWIT5 when you check out. And by Stamps.com. Start using your time more effectively with Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it right from your desk. For our special offer, go to Stamps.com now, click the microphone, and enter TWIT. And by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get 2 free books. Go to audible.com/twit2. And don't forget to follow Audible on Twitter. User ID audible_com. Time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the latest tech news. And, of course, the post-CES show is always a mixed bag, made up of people who are exhausted and have nothing more to say about CES and people who didn't go and were still bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. That's Serenity Caldwell in this case. You didn't go, right?
I did not this year. I managed somehow to get it off.
And I just got off a boat, so I'm rested but completely confused. And I'm still going like this. But look who's back from CES, Jason Heiner. He's a little...
Hello! Did we start? Okay.
Hello, Editor-in-Chief, yeah. Tech Republic. Welcome home.
Thank you. Yes, back from Las Vegas, the worst city in the world.
Oh, man. And brand new to the show, and I'm really glad to have him, Michael Nunez, who is the technology editor at Popular Science, one of the great magazines of all time. It's great to have you on the show, Michael. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is great. I'm glad I could join today.
You just got home.
Yeah. So if I'm a little rough around the edges or my ideas are incomplete, I'm going to go ahead and apologize in advance because, I'm still sort of adjusting to the Eastern time zone.
And we got to wrap this up because the Golden Globes is on tonight, and I can't wait to see what a hash Ricky Gervais makes of it all. He's already tweeted, by the way. I can't show his tweet on the air because it's highly impolite, but I can show his picture. This is minutes ago, Ricky Gervais, who will once again host the Golden Globes, and he says, time to get up, get dressed, and perform for a bunch of humorless, and then he says a very bad word indeed. Setting the stage for what should be a very good Golden Globes tonight.
At least he has a sense of humor about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nobody, not an easy job.
The awards themselves are kind of ridiculous because it's the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, but it's the only award show where people are drinking during, and after. So anything goes. I bet, Serenity, you seem like a Golden Globes enjoyer.
In my former film life, it was definitely something where my film friends and I would just sit around and snark.
I think it was Christina Warren who got me into this, actually.
She
was the first to tell me, oh, no, you have to watch this show because everybody's the drunk.
Exactly. The Globes is the perennial, cluster fan, to put it in polite context.
Nicely said.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. It's a fun thing.
So CES, which stands for nothing in more ways than one. It used to be the Consumer Electronics Show. And then for reasons no one will understand, the CEA, which also is renamed, I think renamed itself, decided it doesn't stand for anything. It's just CES.
CTA.
Now CTA.
consumer technology. So
are they trying to confuse people? What is it? They don't like the word consumer electronics?
Well, I think that it's been more consumer electronics sounds like, you know, your VCR from the 1980s. You know, right. It's like I think they're trying to embrace the fact that everybody's that comes there and the vendors that come there are much broader. It's like really dominated by the car companies this year, by the way.
Yeah, which is interesting because the Detroit Auto Show is this week.
Yes.
Which would be the natural place for car companies to go, except that they're trying to pretend that they're not cars, but consumer electronics devices.
So they're computers on wheels.
They're computers on wheels. Exactly. Well,
yeah, I think that was the major sentiment this year was that, you know, the Detroit Auto Show would be a great launching pad for new like 2017 models and sports cars from American brands. But the more interesting stuff is what's happening in the cabins and in the motors of these vehicles. So, for instance, the BMW i8, the Ford GT, some of these futuristic cars were rolled out into the CES showroom. And yeah, I mean, I think, you know, people like me who are generally like not that interested in cars were actually attracted to these really well designed computers on wheels. As you said, it's a weird time to be looking at automotives.
And the best of CES, and I'm sure at least according to Engadget, was in fact the Chevy Bolt, not Volt. Bolt, which is
the Bolt EV,
electric vehicle with a 200 mile range, which is a lot for an electric vehicle.
It's and so close to being what I want.
And a $30,000 price tag. What's missing?
Yeah. About 100 miles on the range.
Oh.
Yeah. I would say a nice design would be on my list. But I mean, obviously it's great. You know, these electric vehicles that can drive a long distance are awesome, but I don't understand why they can't just look like normal cars. I mean, this thing is closer to a minivan.
They do kind of all have to have swoopy doopy lines. Like they're trying to make them look a little futuristic, don't they?
They're trying to make it. Yeah. I mean, they're copying the Honda Fit. They're copying.
Right.
They're copying in some ways the Prius C. Although I think my Prius C looks heads and tails better than that one. I mean, some of it is just, you know, design. It's Chevy trying to follow the trend instead of set the trend, which is whatever. But and also, you know, you have to have something that's easily manufacturable on a grand scale.
Right.
Because if they're selling this as this is our consumer electronic or our consumer electronics, our consumer EV car,
right.
Like this is the car that everyone that's affordable for everyone, not just affordable for people who want to give EV a spin or people who have enough money to pay for Teslas. They need it to be very, very cheap to manufacture the chassis and the interiors because chances are they're still spending a buttload on battery and all of that nonsense.
This is like a Tesla. The battery's all in the bottom, so which gives it good stability both for handling and just tip ability.
Yeah,
and
it was big. I mean, I think it was clearly the biggest thing of the show.
Bigger than the Samsung refrigerator with the camera inside.
Stop.
Bigger than that.
Stop.
That got a lot of attention.
It was
for it's reasons true. I don't understand. I mean, it's not the first CES Samsung has introduced a computer refrigerator. It's probably the 10th.
Yeah.
But this one is a touchscreen.
Oh, ooh. And you close the door and the light stays on because you got a camera.
Well, you know, you can blame some of that to some of the inexperienced writers and editors that were there. But I mean, I wouldn't consider that one of the best things that I saw.
No, and if you're just first CES, then maybe. But no, yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, smart refrigerators. I think people are generally interested to see like how quickly this stuff is going to be put into our homes. And so, you know, it's nice to take a look at what's going on in those things and to pay attention to how computers are being embedded in everyday objects. But like, you know, there would be very few people that would actually tell you that was one of the biggest pieces of news. I think it was all about virtual reality this year and you know, self-driving cars and some of these new car features, like you were saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, the cool thing about the, you know, the car thing was the biggest leap forward, I thought. For the past few years, they've, and I wrote a story about this, you know, called Self-Driving Cars Won the Week at CES 2016. You know, in the past years, they've talked a little bit about these things, but, you know, a lot happened this year in this space, both with kind of EVs and autonomous. I mean, Google in 2015, in the past year, Google said they're going to have one ready for consumers by 2020, or that they think that there will be consumer, you know, autonomous vehicles by 2020. Tesla had their big download, $2,500 download that turned your Tesla Model S into a self-driving vehicle, or at least sort of the beta version of one.
And this weekend, Apple, Elon Musk said by 2018, your S will come to you automatically.
Yes, he said, you know, he upgraded his prediction in, you know, this fall. He said, we're going to have the technology ready in 2 years. And he said it'll take longer with regulations and those kinds of things before they're in the hands of consumers. But he said the technology will be ready in 2 years. And then there was also the rumor, of course, not just rumor. It was based on The Guardian found these public documents that showed that Apple was working on an electronic vehicle that was also autonomous.
Right.
And so, you know, I think the automakers felt a lot of pressure because of that. And you saw it in spades. Every single one of them was demoing or talking about their path to an autonomous vehicle.
MN7 in our chat room says, it's news when Samsung makes a refrigerator that comes to me. That I'd buy. Come to me.
I want food that'll travel in like pneumatic tubes and just pump itself into the fridge.
So this Bolt looks, I'm on the waiting list for a Tesla, the X, the Falcon Wing or whatever it is, the Hawk Wing.
Yes.
But I'm not, now I'm thinking, I'm looking at this Bolt. It's about a third the price. It's got almost the same range. It has CarPlay or Android Auto, which the Tesla does not. And I think that's pretty important for me. And it has a rear view mirror that's a camera.
Camera.
Camera mirror. My mother.
Camera mirror.
Which is much safer, by the way. It has a much wider angle and a much fuller view. It's far safer.
But it looks, I mean, come on, do you really want to be seen driving something that looks like that, like the Chevy Bolt?
Well, seen with something with a car? Doors go like that? I don't.
Oh, yeah. It's a back to the future, man.
Really?
Yeah, this thing looks...
You don't like the Bolt?
I don't like the design. I mean, I don't understand why they couldn't shape it like a Toyota Camry or something.
Make it a sedan. This is a crossover, I think is the technical term.
Yeah.
It does have a lot of luggage space. What did they say, 500 cubic feet? That can't be right. That's the size of a cruise ship. What? I must have that wrong.
One vehicle that sort of got overlooked was the that looks decent and is autonomous and an EV is the Kia Soul EV. This is I put a picture of it in the top of my article on self-driving cars.
Okay.
But the Kia Soul EV autonomous is actually being tested on public roads in Nevada this year. So it's an EV. It's autonomous. It's got a decent design because it's based on a real design that's out there. And it's going to be.
You think this is good looking?
Well, I don't. I think it's better looking than the.
It looks like a shoe.
The GM
looks like the.
Oh, I hate the box. I hate it so much.
The boxy is really in right now, right?
Yeah, like it is.
I know.
The Scion and the
totally.
It's not
totally.
My style.
Yeah.
So yeah, people love it or hate it in terms of the box.
Ultimately, for EV, my big things are not necessarily style. I love looking at stylish cars, but when it comes to actually buying a day-to-day vehicle, what I care about is reliability.
Yeah.
And I would love, I've been driving a Prius for the last year and a half, and I've become spoiled by gas mileage, and I will never go back to an all-gas car, however pretty it looks. But when it comes to, I would love for my next car to be straight EV, but I need at least 250-mile range.
Electric engines are more reliable, but the batteries are still a little bit of an unknown.
They're expensive to repair, too.
This is kind of exactly what I said in my article, though, Serenity. This is what you're getting at. I think the future... So cars have always been about style, and they're still about style to a degree. Obviously, we've been talking about it in terms of what Leo wants to buy next.
Yes, but please. Let's talk about me.
The future of cars, this is what I wrote, was that the future cars are going to be defined more by software and algorithms than by steel and rubber, right? It's going to be these cars of the future are going to be shells for a lot of big data and algorithms, deep learning, all kinds of course, the infotainment systems as well. Cloud. It's going to really take until we get to, we're not really going to get that EV and that autonomous vehicle, even the really great ones, until there's probably 5G, until there's, the processing power is a little stronger. But it sets up really well for all these chip companies because these cars are going to need an incredible amount of code and incredible amount of processing power.
Right.
I mean, they already have a lot. Ford said this week that the F-150 has 150,000 lines of code in it. And I said, well, how much does that one have? They had the next, this was in their booth where they had their self-driving testing vehicle. And they said a lot more than that. They didn't even know.
150,000 is not that much, really.
That's true. 150,000.
Windows is what, 50 million or 150 million? So it's a huge amount. So there's two things here. There's, of course, electric vehicles, which are, being furthered by federal regulation and new emissions rules. I mean, that's really being pushed. But then there's also autonomy. And and it's interesting you mentioned Nevada, Jason, because in some ways, state governments are really a mixed bag on this. Nevada's kind of very autonomous friendly. California just made a rule that said that autonomous vehicles not only have to have a steering wheel, a gas pedal, and a brake pedal, but a driver in the car who's licensed to drive an autonomous vehicle. They've made it very difficult.
Yeah. There's a lot more people in California, too, right? Nevada's a lot.
Yeah, so big deal. In fact, Nevada has self-driving cars, big deal. You know, what you really want is urban air. In my opinion, is urban areas. We talked yesterday about this on the new Screensavers with Sam Abulmasamid, who's a longtime automotive watcher. He writes about automotive technology for Navigant. He's an analyst. And he was the opinion, and I'm interested what you guys think of this, that the way that autonomous vehicles are going to happen, but they're going to happen in an interesting and unique way, that urban areas, he said, you know, in London you already have a kind of a no-drive zone where you have to pay extra to drive in this area. He said, what's going to happen, like Singapore too, what's going to happen in these very dense urban areas is you're going to have an autonomous vehicle zone. Because the real problem with autonomous vehicles is not the cars, the software, it's the humans driving the other cars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he said, what's going to happen is you're going to have autonomous only areas. You'll arrive at the edge of this area, get out of your car, and an Uber or a Lyft or something will arrive to pick you up. And that's what you'll use to navigate these urban areas. That makes a lot of sense to me.
It does. Totally agree with that.
Go ahead, Serenity.
Sorry. Yeah.
No, it's heightened public transit in a way, except we're all going to be paying for it. It's essentially like taking a bus or taking a train, except for the fact that now it may either be your car that's autonomous,
right,
or you may be restricted to, again, a park and ride. But instead of you're parking your car, instead of getting on a train, you're getting into an Uber or you're getting into a Lyft or you're getting into an Apple car or a Google car. I can absolutely see that happening. And I'm actually not opposed to regulation. Like, I'm not opposed to California's regulations at present time, because when we think about what autonomous vehicles look like at the present day, including stuff like what Tesla's testing with the Model S, we're not in a position where I think anybody feels comfortable having completely autonomous vehicles on the road that don't have gas pedals, that can't be
taken over.
It's going
to be a challenge for me to get in a living room on wheels and let it drive me somewhere. It's going to be a scary moment that first time. Not so scary in a congested urban area where it's not going very fast and everything else is autonomous. That's almost like getting in a train or getting in a monorail or something. That's not as scary.
I mean,
that's really easy to imagine. I mean, I feel like Uber's presence in New York is, it's everywhere. Everyone is using Uber. Everyone I know is using Uber several times a week.
There's some argument that all these extra cars on the road is one of the reasons why New York congestion has gotten worse, not better.
Oh, yeah. I think, of course.
Right? And when you consider the implications of big data, if you have a lot of autonomous vehicles cooperating with each other, traffic will definitely decrease.
Yeah.
Right now, Uber is basically door-to-door service, right? So if I wanted to get to my office to get ready for this podcast, taking an Uber from my door at my apartment to my door at the office. And in the future, there's
already, by the way, it's probably cheaper for you to do that than to own a car, right?
Oh, in the city. Absolutely.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Car ownership is very expensive in New York City because you have to park, you have to insurance.
Insurance is higher than anywhere in the world in Kings County. And so, or in the state, I mean, but I think for, a lot of people that are already working in the city using Uber regularly, it's obvious because companies are already tracking this traffic information and they're using it in services like Google Maps and in Uber and other software. And so, I guess my version of the future is exactly that, or sort of what I see is exactly that, but just without the driver. You know, instead of having the small talk conversations with people that have been driving for years or are starting to use Uber, no driver, please. You know, in the future, I'll be able to just read a magazine or relax or you know, just do something fun.
And Serenity, as a woman, you might feel safer in a driverless vehicle. Really, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there is a real advantage to being picked up at, say, you know, 11 or 12 at night and not having to get into a car with a stranger.
Strange guy, yeah.
The point, well, when I'm in San Francisco, you know, Uber is pretty much a necessity if you're getting around and you're a guest in San Francisco, or a taxi. But lately I've actually requested like the black cars as opposed to Uber X's, just because it, you know, they're usually licensed, licensed livery companies. So it's a little bit more of a safety thing. But Uber is interesting to me. You know, I heard a fact, I wish I knew the origin of this, and I can't. So I don't have the data on it. But I was in a conversation with a friend who told me that Uber makes a map of the city every time it drives around in 7 seconds at the beginning of 2015, and they were trying to get that down to 4.
Wow!
Which is really, like, when you think about how fast Uber, like how fast being able to map a city when you have that many cars on the road, and what that might mean for autonomy and working with working with roads. It's incredible.
Exactly. And it's the private companies that are gathering all of this information. Don't forget, you know, Waze is another big company that has a lot of traffic information. And all of this is going into the hands of private companies that have business interest in lowering traffic and getting people to their point of destination faster. So I think that, you know, it's just an infrastructure issue. I think on the technology side, like, it's all there. Our GPUs are fast enough to process this information. There have been live demonstrations of autonomous vehicles for several years now, and they're only going to get better. So I think, you know, the price has to come down for the average consumer, and obviously they have to start making these things for everyone to buy. But
that's what's interesting. I think it may also be the end of personal car ownership ultimately, right?
Yeah.
Well, it'll be a luxury.
It's a luxury, yeah.
It'll be a huge luxury. I mean, when I talked to the automakers, they said actually what we started this conversation with, which was that the first place you're going to see these is in fleets, that they're going to be really expensive. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be meant for average consumers to start with, unless you're, you know, a Tesla owner.
I'm thinking this might be the last car I ever buy.
I mean, it very well could be, you know.
Partly because I'm really old. They won't let me drive a car in a few years. So.
But it makes absolute sense for them to deploy them in fleets, especially in urban areas.
I think but kind of underlining that, though, and what Michael said is, and every time I've talked to autonomous experts, including a few years ago, a Google guy, they've told me, the technology's there. That's not the problem.
Yeah.
It's psychological. It's governmental. You know, there are other issues, but we've got the technology to do this.
Yeah, Honda was talking about, when I met with them last year, they were talking about this vision that they had for this in commuter areas, these super fast lanes with autonomous vehicles that sense each other. They could go 100 to 120 miles an hour, and only autonomous vehicles could go in there. Humans, their reaction time is not fast enough, right?
Right.
But that people would be able to commute. They felt like, you know, up to 150 to 200 miles a day. If we could have, you know, that kind of infrastructure in place.
Predictions, anybody? How soon is this all going to happen? Is it in the next decade? Is it in 20 years, 50 years?
5 years. Within 5 years. 4 to 5.
You agree, Michael?
I would say
Serenity?
Longer. I totally disagree. I think it's going to take up to 10 years. I mean, the product cycles on these cars are ridiculous. The fact that they're just getting gesture control is obnoxious, in my opinion. That's something that's been available in the Xbox, you know, and Wii and a number of
other. You
want
to drive your car like in Minority Report?
They're going to be on the road in 2016.
I do gestures in my car, but I don't think they would help drive.
They're going to be on the road in 2016. In a number of states, they're going to be on the road. I mean, there's no.
No, they are. I think it's really always hard with technology to predict. This is one technology I think is sooner than you think. Partly because insurance companies, but also the number of deaths, road deaths now, thousands of road deaths due to distracted driving.
33,000 a year in the U.S. Yeah.
Yeah. This is going to be a bigger and bigger issue.
I mean, I think that once the tech is going to be here without a doubt in 5 years.
Yeah.
I think what's going to dictate what happens in cities and what happens in rural areas is largely based on how they can show regulators that the tech is A, safe, B, can make the moral decisions of, like, let's say I'm coming around a cliff.
Don't
and
get
kid
the moral decision.
No.
Because
that's the scary part, right?
Yeah. Yes.
You're going on a cliff. A kid walks in front of you. Do you save the tiny human and go off the cliff and die, or do you kill the tiny human and save yourself? Like that's a moral dilemma that unfortunately that's really hard for a car to. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And those kinds of things. Granted, that's an obscure case, and we're talking about a rural situation here. But that's still; those are the kinds of things that regulators have to think about when they're saying, "Yes, we will allow autonomous cars everywhere," because everywhere means, you know, as the random remote rural areas.
No, it won't happen everywhere, but I think that I will be riding an autonomous vehicle in a congested urban area in the next 5 years. I think.
Oh, I absolutely believe it, especially if you're going to San Francisco.
Yep.
I think
San Francisco
will probably
Manhattan. Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah.
London.
Yeah. Yep.
All right, let's take a break. We'll come back with more. That's just one story from CES, I guess the most important story, but there's VR goggles and segues and all sorts of stuff to talk about. We've got a great panel to do it too. Michael Nunez is joining us for the very first time for Popular Science Magazine. He's their technology editor. Great to have you, Michael. You fit right in. You're just a natural. Also, Serenity Caldwell, our favorite roller derby artist, explainer of all things Macintosh at imore.com. I didn't know you were. Is this new managing editor? Is that a new title?
No, I've always been the managing editor of iOS. And when we reduced staff a little bit and rejiggered, I'm now the overall managing editor.
And Renee is the editor in chief.
Yep.
Wow.
Renee's editor in chief / editor at large, and is also working with some of the overarching stuff at Mobile Nations.
Oh, you know what that means. He's on the Jason Snell career path.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, if we didn't know that about Renee Ritchie already.
All right. Now I understand. But that's good for you, Serenity. Get that dead wood out of the way. And also with us, Jason Heiner, who is an editor-in-chief at Tech Republic. This might be politically charged for you. Did CNET give up the best of CES to Engadget this year? I think they did.
That was last year.
Last year.
Last year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because AOL spends a lot of money on CES. And of course, Engadget's AOL. Big lobby studio.
And TechCrunch as well. They own TechCrunch as well.
Right.
And they had huge studios for both. This was the biggest that I'd ever seen them have. You know,
and the irony is, and of course, it makes sense because it's AOL, CES is less and less relevant every year. But their coverage, bigger and bigger.
Yeah, CNET had huge coverage too. CNET was just everything, and they still have a bigger stage than guys.
I have to say, I feel like, especially in this modern age with the internet and companies doing their own thing, these big trade shows don't have long for this world. And yet, CES seems to buck that trend. I don't know why.
I mean, yeah, it's still
it does.
I would say it was busier this year than it was last year. There are a lot of haters out there and that say CES isn't relevant, but I would say it's the best place to find just demonstrations of the most cutting edge technology. So you might not get your new iPhone, but you are going to see things like gesture controls in cars and virtual reality headsets and, you know, a lot of different augmented reality headsets. And so if you're able to see all of that, you should be able to make determinations about when to expect all of this stuff to hit consumers. And so for me, it's hugely helpful.
Okay.
And
fair enough.
I still find it useful. There's a lot of noise and a lot of useless stuff, but there's also a lot of vision for, you know, roadmaps for where
it is one
going.
Place you can That's go not- to kind of see it all, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is the worst part of it too. Because
there's
so much you can't see it all.
Right.
And then, you know, so yeah.
And when it comes to TVs, you have to see it in person. You can't judge whether HDR, for instance, is going to make a difference unless you see a good HDR screen in person.
Pictures of pictures don't really mean anything.
Right.
The cool thing about CES to me is it always feels a little bit Walt Disney-ish. It always feels like World of Tomorrow, you know, let's go to the Expo World's Fair. There aren't, you know, World's Fairs don't exist anymore. They're kind of an old world thing. But CES very much feels like a World's Fair to me, where all of the best and brightest, you know, the best and brightest of technology from big giant companies to little bitty places in Shenzhen all come together and they're like, here's what we have. Here's what we've been playing with. And of course, there are companies that don't go to the shows anymore, but they have their own events and it's very easy to find out, you know, what Apple's doing next, because Apple will let you know when it's ready to announce something.
Right. You don't need to go to CES for Apple.
But if you want to, you know, if you want a wide swath of like what are the trends in home automation? What are the trends in cars this year? What are the trends in television? It's a really good show to get trends and just see goofy stuff. Like there's last year when I was there, there were so many robots, so many adorable robots that I was just like, you know, I may never have any of these in my house, but I'm so glad that I get to walk among rows of like really ridiculous robots and like see a R2-D2 that can also be a beer fridge. Like,
yeah. That's the stuff that makes me think I don't care. I don't mind missing this.
I made robot friends. I made some friends with some robots.
You like the robots though. I've seen you shaking hands with Asimo.
I do. Yeah. I do.
You like the robots. Yeah. We're going to take a break, come back. Please, those of you just returning from CES, do not listen to this next commercial. It might put you to sleep. The rest of you, I want to tell you about my mattress. Casper mattress. Not only did I sleep on a Casper mattress, I slept on Casper pillows last night. They sent me some pillows as a, I guess, a Christmas gift. I don't know. Man, I'm in heaven.
So jealous.
Oh, they're nice. Casper is an online retailer of premium mattresses made in the USA. And because they don't have showrooms, it's a fraction of the cost. They actually come to you in a box, really surprisingly small box. You open it up and you got a mattress. Combining latex and memory foam. Now, I almost don't want to say that because I think sometimes people have preconceived notions from experiences with other mattresses. The way they've done it is amazing. It's cool. It breathes. It's not too smushy. But it's not too firm. It's really you got to try it. And the nice thing is you can for 100 days, risk-free. You can buy it online. They'll send it to you in that nice box. You open it up. You put it on your bed. If you feel nervous, keep your old mattress around. Anytime in that first 100 days, you call them. If you don't like it, you call them and say, take it back. A courier comes. They take it back. They actually donate it to a local charity. And you're back to where you were at no cost to you. They refund every penny. But that's just, I think, to reassure people, because you're not going to do that. You're going to love this thing. This is so much better than trying a bed in a showroom. Sleep on it. Casper mattresses. $500 for a twin. Their biggest mattress, the king size, $950. Compare that to a premium mattress at the mattress store down the street. You'll see this is a very good deal. And it's even less if you use the offer code TWIT at casper.com/twit. We'll take $50 off any mattress. Some terms and conditions do apply. Find out more. Casper, casper.com/terms. I don't know what they're putting in those pillows, but they are phenomenal. Phenomenal.
I need to try them.
Really? You want to? I can get you. I'm going to send you a pillow. I don't know about mattress.
I got the mattress.
Oh, you got the mattress.
Yeah, I have that. I have the crazy story about the mattress where we came back from vacation and the cat had gotten locked in our bedroom and peed all over our old mattress.
We had
guests coming, so I actually we were looking at a Casper anyway. Hey, Casper, is there any way that I can get this in like 40 hours because I have a guest coming and I would like her not to sleep on things?
Awesome.
And they express shipped me a thing and now we have a Casper mattress.
Aren't they the greatest? They're nice service, nice people. I got a cat story for you. We went on, as you know, we were gone for a week on a cruise. And day one of the cruise, we get a call from Lisa's nephews watching the house. The cat's disappeared. And we spent the whole cruise worried about the cat. They never found the cat. They would put up posters everywhere. We got back, no cat. Lisa was going. Lisa is a dedicated cat owner, my wife. She went out every night, every day, looking, kitty, kiki. And so Wednesday, she hears some meowing. The cat is on the neighbor's roof. She's been on the neighbor's roof for 10 days. Couldn't figure out how to get down. The neighbor said, yeah, we heard mewing. We couldn't She survived, though, even though pouring torrential rains. And I don't know. Cats are kind of interesting critters. So I know that's – I sympathize with your story, Serenity. They can get everywhere.
Oh.
She's now an indoor cat, I might add.
Yeah.
No, not going out. Lisa's decided, oh, she's a dumb cat. Some cats will not go places they can't get back from. This one, no. It's not her first time. She got locked in the neighbor's garage earlier. All right, moving on. CES. Open panel. What else did you see at CES? Let me start with you, Michael, since you're our virgin. What else did you see that was worth noting at CES this week?
Wow, big question. I would say by far and away, my favorite part of CES was trying out the new virtual reality headsets. So there are three major ones, obviously Oculus, one from Sony that connects to the PlayStation, and then HTC is making one with the gaming company Valve.
Yeah.
Called the Vive, correct? And so it was great to try all of those out and see how they compared against each other, basically, and to see where some excelled and where others didn't. And, you know, all three will be released later this year, which is exciting. And I think it's going to be a pretty big deal among gamers. Maybe not for the average consumer, but anyone that's playing first-person shooters on an Xbox One or a PlayStation is going to want to try gaming at the next level, which is in virtual reality.
I was a little disappointed because a couple of things happened. First of all, I saw that announcement that the Oculus Rift was available. I think a little more than we expected, $599.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, their CEO said, or not CEO, founder, one of the founders, Palmer Luckey, said $350 last year.
A little expensive. And then they also mentioned that the Touch, which I think is fairly important, and people who've used it say it is, not till the end of the year. That's delayed now. And I tried all my Windows PCs. None of them are smart or powerful enough for the Oculus Rift. So now I not only have a $599 Rift, but I got a. We're gonna build a.
Get a PC.
We're gonna build a PC for it
for at least a grand.
At least a grand. Yeah. We're gonna actually make us kind of top. We're gonna make the ultimate VR gaming machine, or Avrugger.
Nice.
Avrugram. Because we used to do Uggams, remember, on the screensaver. So we're gonna build that. And then after all that, I found out I could have gotten a free one. I am getting a free one because I kickstarted it way back when. And actually, a little pat on the back to Oculus for doing this.
Yeah.
20,000 or whatever early adopters who kicked in money on Kickstarter before Facebook bought them, and I was one of them, will all be getting a free Oculus Rift. So that's nice. So now I have two.
In case you want to use it twice.
Well, there's social VR too. Don't forget, you know, you can have a friend join you.
That's what I'm thinking.
Do not ever be in the same room with a person and have one of these headsets.
Why not?
Because you look like an absolute dork. Yeah, and you run into each other. Look at CES. These things were everywhere. And the worst was Samsung had this big theater with full of it. I have a photo of it.
Yeah, I saw that
on Instagram. And it was like, when I posted it, I was like, this will never make you put on a VR headset.
It reminded me a lot of the pictures you saw in the 50s of people in 3D theaters wearing those stupid red and green glasses.
It's even worse, too, but because you see people like they're looking around and they're, you know, looking up and then they're like, oh, it's like. I mean, you just look ridiculous when you're wearing one of these things, and you see people like taking videos and they're, you know, playing the games and everything. I mean, it's just socially they are not meant to be used in company. I think only online company, virtual company, unless they make one. I also tweeted this like on the last day of CES. One thing that was clear to me was like these things are not meant to be used in company unless they make one that looks like a Daft Punk helmet. If they make
something
look like a Daft Punk
helmet, that'd be
kind of awesome. Then I'm in.
Then you really will be up all night to get lucky. little Daft Punk humor there. Three that you tried, Michael, did you have a favorite?
So I've been following these pretty closely over the past year, and I would say the new HTC Vive Pre, it's the second generation of their developer kit, was the most impressive. They added this front-facing camera to the VR headset. So there's an element of mixed reality. Basically, if you were playing in your living room and there was a coffee table in front of you or a chair or anything else that you wouldn't want to bump into, the VR headset would show you virtually.
I like that
you're getting near it. Yeah, so it makes it a lot more accessible to people. And also because of the that headset also has spatial recognition. So you mount these little IR blasters basically, and it's tracking your movement within the room. So you can walk around, You can grab things in the virtual world, and you don't have to worry about bumping into furniture or anything that you wouldn't want to knock over. And obviously, their partnership with Valve makes it really attractive to a guy like me, because Valve makes some of the best video games in the world, and they're one of the best gaming distribution platforms in the world. And I think that partnership can matter a lot going forward, especially once people start sinking like $1,200 into their VR machines and are going to want the most powerful and most immersive experience. So
yeah.
that was my
same
favorite
conclusion.
Yeah, you like the Vive the best too. Yeah.
Yeah. We have a writer and editor, Aaron Carson, who's been writing about VR for all year, has tested all of them. Recently was at HTC at their headquarters up in Seattle and tested the recent one, and then tested the new one they released at CES. Has tested all of them, and her conclusion is the same: is that technically, in terms of the technology, the Vive is the best one.
Is it also frame has
the best rate? Hand controllers. I don't think it's frame rate. I think it's content. I think it's also controllers. Their controller. They have the controllers like the ones that like the touch controllers, the Oculus ones. But they already have them. They're going to come out when the device comes out in the first half of the year. And she said they're easier to use. She's tested the Half Moon controllers, the ones that you're talking about, the touch controllers. And she said they're much more complicated to use. There's a lot more buttons. There's a lot more going on there. And also, this is kind of what we care about, obviously, is not just the uses for gaming, but the uses for all kinds of other things, training and presentations.
Yeah, marketing. But isn't it gaming that's going to just propel this forward? I mean, the gamers are the ones who are going to spend $500, $600 on this as an accessory. Isn't that really
Enterprise
where...
Enterprise will, too. I mean, right? Enterprise will, too, if it's getting you into... You actually saw this at CES. There was a couple of these smart home companies that it was really hard, especially like at Showstoppers and the little shows, the shows outside the shows, to show off their whole product. But they gave you a VR headset, and then that showed their product, and it was actually quite effective. And so for uses like that, I think you're going to see also healthcare is all over this. Education is all over this. There's a lot of potential uses for these things. And HTC is playing that game better. They're off to a better start than Oculus. They're really looking at. They're taking that, I think, more seriously than what Oculus is, which they're really focused on gaming, which is what, Palmer, Luckey and those guys have been focused on at the beginning. It's really the hardcore gamer. So from that standpoint, I think HTC has a lot of potential too. Obviously, HTC as a company has some troubles, and it's not as good of a patron for the Vive as Facebook is for Oculus. So you have to keep that in mind as well.
Vive was the best gaming product at CES, according to Engadget. The Vive Chaperone. What's the Chaperone? Is that it?
The Chaperone is what I described as the feature that prevents you from bumping into things in your living room. So a Chaperone sort of comes into the game. It doesn't fully remove you from your virtual world.
I like it, though, but watch the table. Yeah. Watch out for the table.
Yeah, I mean, it's a serious problem when you're asking people to set aside room for, most people don't have a room that they can dedicate to virtual reality. So they're going to be playing them in their living rooms. And to accommodate for that is a smart move. And just back to this gaming versus enterprise thing. I mean, I think there will be, of course, enterprise use cases for a lot of VR headsets. But for the most part, I think you're going to see augmented reality and mixed reality making use of, used in a lot of enterprise settings and for productivity. I think virtual reality, because it's so immersive and because it removes you from the room, I think in a lot of cases you're going to see them used for entertainment. So whether it's watching a movie and feeling like you're the only guy in the theater, or in a war zone in a first-person shooter, or even just light drawing, which is a really fun thing to do in the Vive, because you can walk around your drawing and see it in 3D.
Oh, wow.
And that type of stuff's really exciting. But again, those are all those are all forms of entertainment. They're not, they haven't really demonstrated how you might use this to practice surgery or something. And of course, that will be available. But I think what I have seen is like a lot of big companies are more interested in translucent displays that allow you to merge digital information with real world information. So, you know, if you're performing surgery, let's say, you might have digital information overlaid on your practice dummy or on a human, or, you know, as you're watching someone do surgery. Whereas VR, it's just because of the controllers and because of some of the limitations with how you use your hands and how you interact with the virtual environments, I think for the most case, there's a limitation there. You just won't see a lot of productivity uses for these VR headsets. And certainly social VR.
Training.
And yeah,
things like that. You'll see it. But yeah, I agree. AR is the bigger opportunity. And we saw that at CES too. Sony has AR glasses, enterprise glasses, Epson, some other companies as well.
HoloLens, not there though, right? Microsoft wasn't there.
Yeah. They weren't there. They weren't even given demos.
Yeah. They showed their most recent iteration of the HoloLens.
They don't go to CES anymore.
No, they've stopped going to CES.
They don't need that.
And the HoloLens isn't ready yet either.
Yeah. Hey, okay, so I asked Michael, Jason, your pick, anything at CES besides VR and electric vehicles, what else?
Jason, I'll let you answer this one.
Yeah, Jason, this is for Jason, yeah.
Cool, yeah, so...
How about TVs? So, did you see any TVs you really liked?
No, I said this while I was giving some tours at CES, and of course that's the thing everybody wants to ask about, because that's what you think about when you think of CES. Right. And I said... Look, if you're in the market for a TV, do not buy a 4K. Don't even buy a 4K TV right now.
Not now. There's no content and there's no standard.
Exactly. There's no content. There's no standard. It's going to be 2 years before it's really a thing. You know, who wants to watch House of Cards in 4K anyway, right? It's like it's not a great – that's one of the only really great shows in 4K, and it's not something that's well-suited to it.
Right.
I think the TVs were cool, like HDR, 4K. They look as good. They look, you know, incrementally better than they did last year. But it's kind of hard to get excited about it because it's just going nowhere for a little while still. So, no, I wasn't real excited about the TVs. I thought one of the things, and obviously this is a hazard because of, you know, the stuff that I focus on. But I really did think that more and more the stuff behind the scenes that's powering these is amazing. The things like the data and the AI and the stuff, deep learning, that's powering all of these experiences. You know, CES it's finally kind of caught up with this, is that it's more about experiences and it's more about what you can do with the technology and what the technology does for me or does for my community or does for society.
Right.
Because, you know, it's not just about CES is still a gadget show. It's still a hardware show. And there's cool stuff you see. But more and more, you know, I think the great example is Intel. You go to Intel's booth, you'd be hard pressed to even find a PC there. Right?
Isn't that interesting? Wow.
Yeah. You couldn't even find a PC in that booth.
Why does Intel still go to CES? Apple and Microsoft don't. Why does Intel go?
Yeah. Well, I think Intel, partly because... Intel's chips are powering more and more of these things, right?
It's, and they like want to be mobile. They're not in mobile yet. They'd like to be there.
Yeah, they're getting there, I think. And they know that their future, and they have a brilliant future in the car, in home automation, in you know, the smart devices, and intelligence embedding itself in every bit of these things, every bit of society, essentially.
I will say this about TVs. I was talking with Scott Wilkinson, our home theater guy, who, of course, is hoarse and foot sore from 25 miles this week at CES and mostly looking at TVs. The good news is the UHD Alliance did release a standard called Ultra HD Premium that includes, encompasses the broader color gamut, encompasses HDR, at least provides a standard that you should be looking for. The Blu-ray Alliance has announced a UHD premium Blu-ray player, $500, not bad. So, and movie companies have said there'll be 100 titles in 2016 available for this UHD premium. So we're making some progress. And at least
we all want it.
I want it. Great. I love 4K. I've been for great. 10 years. I saw the first 4K TV at CES 10 years
Me
ago.
Too. Yeah.
And from then on, I said, this is what I forget 3D. I want 4K.
It looks more 3D than 3D, right?
Yeah.
Like a really good
real
4K looks more 3D than 3D. Because it's not a gimmick. You can see the contrast. You can see the edges of things. They really pop out. But
there's no content. So somebody in the chat room said, well, if my TV died today, wouldn't I want to buy a 4K TV?
No. No.
Even today.
Not.
Get a cheap exactly. HD TV.
Mm-hmm. You can get an amazing TV.
Right.
Yeah, you can get an amazing TV.
$2,000, you can get a brilliant 75-inch TV.
Exactly. And then in 2 years, these 4K TVs are going to be obsolete,
especially
with the stuff that we saw at CES this year with HDR and other things. These ones here are going to look like puppies, you know, in a couple years. So that's exactly what I told people. If you're in the market, you got to get a TV now. Get a really great, 1080p TV for between $500 and $1,000. You get amazing, screen because everybody's pushing 4K.
And in a couple of years, maybe LG's OLEDs, the OLED Ultra HD Premium TVs will be affordable.
Yeah.
At least more affordable.
So that was cool.
Didn't they look good?
The things that I liked was the rollable screen from LG,
super cool. Yeah.
Also the glass. There were two. I saw one from Panasonic and one from LG where it was just glass, right? The whole screen was glass. LG did this thing where the whole screen was just a glass as thick as 4 credit cards and clear glass.
Wow.
And then all of the electronics and the speaker was in the base of the thing. And if you hang it on your wall, that base kind of folds under a little bit, you know? And so that was beautiful, I thought, and very cool. And then Panasonic had one where it was just on a bookshelf. I posted a video of this, I think, on Instagram, where it was just a bookshelf. And over part of the bookshelf was this piece of glass. And it was a screen over top of it. And at times it was opaque and at times it was clear where you could see what was behind it. And it was super
cool.
I enjoyed that a lot. I thought that was a neat thing that was really impressive. Because the 4K, as much as I like 4K, as much as you all like 4K, I mean, most people I know, regular humans, can barely tell the difference between SD and HD, right? They're still watching SD channels, and you're like, turn that thing to the HD.
I know. Why are you watching the SD version of this show? You could watch the Golden Globes in HD. No, it looks fine to me.
But I think a lot of people are actually vastly underestimating how quickly 4K will become available to people. So there might not be a lot of 4K content right now. But don't forget, GoPros are shooting in 4K. YouTube's accepting it and trying to create more 4K content. Netflix will be creating all its original series in 4K. So I think that, maybe right at the second there's not a lot of content, but I don't think it will take very long for that content to come out. And sure, like House of Cards is a little dated and not all of that exciting anymore, but there will be a new Netflix show that you're going to want to watch in 4K. And so,
but really, will streaming 4K be anything great?
No, because
they're going to have to compress the hell out of it, don't they?
Do we have gigabit Ethernet? Right. It's a non-starter.
It's just going to slow down your internet to a crawl, and it's going to be too compressed for you to really tell the difference.
Did either of you take a ride in the one-man drone quadcopter?
Oh, my goodness.
No, pretty wild, though.
No,
pretty wild.
It's called the E-Hang.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a great name. And whatever you do, don't step out of it until the rotors stop.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem very, very well thought out. but looks pretty cool, and I guess in theory is interesting. But yeah, I'm not going to be studying anything like that.
Were there any little drones worth mentioning? Anything new there?
DJI I think is way ahead of the trends in a lot of these drone innovations, and they released a new drone ready 4K camera, I think, and some of the controlling apparatuses are a little easier and better, but for the most part you're seeing the same approach to a lot of these drones. They're all quadcopters and they may or may not have a camera. And it's at this point, it's just a lot of it's about control, whether it's partially autonomous or fully autonomous, and how the camera connects to the drone, and whether it's on a gimbal that can be fitted with a Nikon or a Canon or just DJI special camera. And so, I think DJI is ahead of everyone because they make it's sort of a modular design. They make it pretty easy to swap those things in and out. But a lot of the drones are have four propellers and can fly relatively high.
Yeah.
And
good cameras and blah, blah, blah. You covered a little bit the wearables scene. Of course, you'd expect wearables, including this, which is wild, the HTC Under Armour Health Box.
Yeah, this one was pretty interesting. You know, not a lot of new technology there, but you know, it's just
it's a scale, activity tracker, and a heart rate monitor all in a box.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, so I think up until this point, you know, a lot of people associated Fitbit with the health tracker, Polar with the heart rate monitor, right. And then I think Withings might have a smart scale.
Under Armour's gotten very aggressive in this.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think they have to be. They want to compete against the top American sports brands, Adidas and Nike. And this is definitely one way to do it. So there are three different companies that worked on this particular package. It's being marketed under Under Armour, but HTC designed all of the hardware. And then actually they worked with a consulting group. I believe it's called Wolfgang Mueller to identify this as something that people would want. And I think they're correct to do so. I mean, as I said, these products exist and with other companies, but they're not all within the same ecosystem. And so for the really like fitness crazy, a very active type of person that wants the full spectrum of health information at their fingertips, I think Under Armour and HTC have done a pretty good job of at least packaging it well. You know, I wouldn't say this is technological breakthrough by any means. All of this stuff has existed for several years.
Yeah, but it's all in one.
But the data on the back end is, because it's actually powered by IBM Watson. And so,
you weren't joking when you said Watson, Serenity.
It's powered by Watson on the back end, and so
Dave, you're dead.
Advanced analytics on your so it tells you sort of how you're doing, and it has this essential virtual coach and virtual trainer.
Don't eat that hot dog, Dave.
that it's showing you. It's triangulating all your data sources, and then it gives you so that UA Record, I think, is the name of the app. You can use that now even without their health box. And that will power, so you can use it with your other
Under Armour has been on an acquisition spree on apps, health and tracker apps.
Yes.
They really, I think, want to be the place for all of this. They bought MyFitnessPal. It's interesting. Yep. It's going to be them and Runtastic probably will be the two big software companies. How about Fitbit? I thought this Fitbit Blaze, in fact, I pre-ordered it immediately, $200 smartwatch with Fitbit technology in it. Serenity, I know, of course, you're an Apple Watch fan, but did this intrigue you at all? It does do notifications.
So it did intrigue me up to the point where some of my coworkers saw it in person.
It's kind of ugly.
It's ugly and it's big. This is the thing that frustrates me.
But it has
me
GPS built into it.
It does not. It has assisted GPS. It has assisted GPS, so it will.
See, that's confusing.
GPS. Like this will.
It says connected GPS. Well, that's an Apple Watch has connected GPS.
Exactly. Yeah. I was really excited because I love, I think the folks behind Fitstar are doing some really great stuff. I have both of those apps.
Fitstar is built into this, right?
Yeah.
They acquired Fitstar. Yeah.
They didn't, I don't know if they've acquired
I think they did.
Partnership.
No, I think they acquired them. Yeah.
They might have, But I mean, Fitstar does some great stuff and Fitbit does great stuff, but right now it's just, it's too bulky. It looks gigantic on a dude's wrist.
Oh.
When you put it on a lady wrist, it looks like you're wearing a giant cuff. I mean, you can look at
it. Yeah, it reminds me of the original Samsung Gear.
That was too big too. That was
cool. It's almost identical.
Okay, I'll cancel my order.
Definitely cancel it. I mean, the other problem with this is the best thing it has going for it is $200, right? It's basically like an Apple Watch for $200. So good for them. That's good. But the design, it looks too much like the Apple Watch, and the Apple Watch is not all that much of a looker by itself.
Right.
And I wear one. I wore Fitbits for a long time, so I've been a fan of both. But the problem with the design is not good, and these things are still fitness. You know, these things have to have some kind of style component if you're going to wear it around all the time. So.
Right.
I think this was an epic fail, and you saw it when the stock dropped 13% the same day and, like, I think 18% within 48 hours after.
The wisdom of the crowds. Well, my order's being shipped, so I guess I'll be wearing that. Ships in March, though. Wait a minute. Can I cancel this? It says your order is in the process of being shipped. Maybe I can cancel it still.
You may just have to email them.
Looking for that cancel button. Cancel.
Please, I don't want it.
I had CES guilt buying.
But I wasn't there.
On the other hand, Samsung released their smartwatch that actually has 3G in it, which I thought was interesting.
Can you make calls?
You don't have to pair it with a device. And so that's it. You can pair it. But I was talking to somebody from Samsung and I was like, well, what about battery, right? That's what everybody's going to ask. And he said, well, this was probably 7 o'clock at night. And he showed me, you know, where he was wearing one. And he said, I've been up since 6 a.m., you know, and I'm at about 40% battery life. So he said, people have been saying they get 2 days out of it. He said, I don't get 2 days. But yeah, there it is. Gear S2 Classic. But he was easily getting in a full day out of it. And he said he's, you know, uses it a good deal. He works out. And
I like the
stuff,
ring. So. That's the one with the ring interface. I like that.
I think the ring looks better. It looks more classic. Yeah. Watch. Now, the 3G version is thicker because it has that radio in it. So, but it is small. Like Sereni was saying that some of these watches, they're just, you could not imagine, a woman wanting to wear one of these things. They're so large. This one actually is smaller. It's smaller than the previous Gear watches. It's also smaller than the Moto 360, which is a nice looking.
Do you have to have a Samsung phone to use this, or can you don't have to have a Samsung phone?
No, you don't. You can, but it can do. I think you might have to set it up with Android. I should qualify that. I think you might have to have Android to set it.
That's not a problem. But some of the previous Samsung watches required you owning a Samsung phone.
Samsung phone.
I don't.
I don't believe so.
I mean, that doesn't.
I have a few Samsung phones lying around.
I think it runs on special Samsung software.
It's Tizen, right?
Android Wear.
No, I'm sure it's Tizen.
It's Tizen. It's not Android Wear.
Yep. It's customized. You know, I like what Samsung's been doing with the watches. I think that it's a different direction in some ways than what the Apple Watch is going, and then very similar in others. I still think it's a little too big, but they have at least been making strides. I remember I tried on the LG Urbane earlier this year.
Huge.
The Urbane with the Moto 360, with the first Samsung Gear, and all of them, I was wearing them up here to make them even look remotely like they belonged on my arm. And even so, I was just kind of like, ugh. It's hard, right? Because you want to be able to put a certain amount of information on the watch. And I won't deny 38 millimeter, like I'm wearing the 38 millimeter watch.
That's the little Apple watch.
Little Apple watch. And it fits my wrist well. But there are definitely times where the space crunch gets to my ability to actually interact with the watch. It's a little harder to tap on than the 42 millimeter and some of the Gear watches I've used. But I still like... There's got to be some way for smaller wristed folks, ladies and dudes, to be able to enjoy these without feeling like they have to wear it boyfriend style, where it just, and that doesn't even work for health sensors. Cause if you're going to wear it that big, the health sensors can't actually tap into your wrist data. So I don't know. I'm hopeful.
Along those lines, Huawei also released their new watch at CES. The Jewel, there's two models, the Jewel and the Elegant. And they say that they were aiming these specifically at women, that they were trying to make it smaller and they were trying to make it more, have more style options available. I still thought they were pretty big. I still thought they were about the same size as the Samsung, even though they had said that. And so, but I thought it was interesting of them to say that they were aiming these specifically at women when they made the announcement at their big press conference there. And it is decent looking. It's very similar looking to that to the Galaxy Gear S2 that we were talking about just a bit ago. But it is also, I think, kudos to both of them for I think some steps forward in style for both of those two watches anyway.
I think
one thing that I noticed at CES was just the level of redundancy with a lot of these wearables. So, there was a lot of excitement surrounding wearables prior to the Apple Watch unveiling, and I think that has sort of calmed down quite a bit in the technology community. They had a lot of these wearables featured in the SANS, which is sort of this secondary part of the of the entire convention. Yeah.
Whoever makes it to the SANS, that's ridiculous.
The SANS was huge really wearables in 2015 last year when I went, so I'm surprised.
So grateful to you guys for risking life and limb.
It's fun. You know what? It's exhausting, but the one I did kind of miss not going to CES this year.
Yeah. FOMO, little FOMO going on.
Yeah, you know, like I said before, it's a little bit like Disneyland for new tech, but I don't know. I'm glad that I didn't go, but I'm
sad. Changed my attitude. I'd be honest with you. I thought it was just crap, and now by the way, Amazon's Echo kind of sneakily became one of the stories at CES. Amazon wasn't there, but a number of companies announced integration, including Ford. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. I think that Echo is rapidly becoming my favorite home tech product.
I've heard so many people say that. Everybody I know that has it loves it. I don't have one. We have one at the office, you know, obviously, that we've tested.
It turns out the voice interface is the best interface, and it just needs to talk to all the automation stuff. And then you just tell the house to do what you want it to do. And it's fine.
The Ford thing was really interesting. Again, it's like data and natural language processing, which is also in this like deep learning and that kind of thing. I saw this in so many products everywhere this year, and I was glad to see it, that it's so much about experiences and rather than just sort of raw hardware kind of thing, as much as even we've been talking about the raw hardware and style and all that, which is great. But design and experiences are what define CES as well as every other bit of the technology world now. And, a lot of this is powered by other sort of back-end systems. And that's why, I asked this of the car makers, because I was like, if that car is a shell for a lot of cloud and data and services and that, then, you guys have some catching up to do. That's why Google and Tesla, that's part of their DNA already. And you guys don't have that as part of your DNA. And so you have some work to do.
Right.
And several of them kind of acknowledged that. And clearly, with all the stuff they were doing with autonomous, they were trying to show that they can, that they have the chops to do it.
Let's take a break. More to come with our panel. Jason Heiner from Tech Republic is here. Serenity Caldwell for iMore.com. Michael Nunez from Popular Science. And I think we've done CES. We'll move on to other topics, including Peach, because that's all I did this weekend. But first, a word about shaving. I did shave, of course, because I have a nice Harry's razor with that great Harry shave cream. I feel pretty darn spiffy. Guys, 2016 is here. It's a new year. It's a fresh start. Maybe time to stop overpaying for a great shave. Harry's was started by two guys passionate about creating a better shaving experience by delivering great blades and shaving cream directly to your door. They also are nice guys. They give 1% of their sales and 1% of their time back to the communities that they serve. So the way Harry's decided to do this is classic startup. They said they investigated, how do we make better blades? How do we make it lower cost? We'll buy the factory in Germany. This is a factory that's been creating the best shaving blades in the world for more than 100 years. Harry's owns it. And so they're selling direct to you from the factory. They design these blades for performance, for beautiful design and engineering and sharpness. Over 1 million guys now have made the switch to Harry's. And it's easy. You go to the website, it'll take you less than 30 seconds to place an order. You'll have a great customer service experience. Start with the Harry's kit. I use the Winston set, and I love it. They're still selling the Winter Winston. I'm glad. That's a beautiful copper handle. There's also the Truman, which is less expensive and a great way to start. Every kit comes with a handle, three blades, the travel cover, and, of course, your choice of Harry's great foaming shave gel or Harry's cream. And all of this is going to cost you about half as much as razor as the big brands in the drugstore. Well, look at the Truman set, $15. $15. And, in fact, I'll get you $5 off your first order when you use the offer code TWIT5 at Harry's, H-A-R-R-Y-S, Harry's.com. Get started with Harry's. Hey, for $10, you can get a real – and by the way, this is not a sample size of the foaming shave gel or the or the cream. It's a full-size tube or the full-size bottle. Harry's.com. Use the offer code TWIT5 and save $5 off your Harry's purchase. I saw you, Serenity, on Peach. Aren't you on Peach?
I am. Yes, I joined pretty quickly because, as I was saying before the show, I have username terror. I want to make sure that my you never know what's going to jump and what's going to not. And
so you just have to get your name everywhere, right?
Yeah, pretty much. So, I mean, granted, not many people but the Swedes are signing up with Saturn, but just on the off chance.
Oh, you know. Jason just joined. Yes. Jason Heiner, brand new on the... I have not decided whether to friend everybody who asks me or not. So I'm just going to say no. What is...
I started at first friending everyone and then realized pretty quickly, you have this nice little list of people where you have your own thing, and then you also have this list of individually you have to tap on people to look
at
them.
There's no timeline on this, which is kind of interesting.
It's just kind of people, and they're out of order, too. It's not like the newest thing.
It's chronological. Oh, no, isn't this the...
I thought it was chronological, but then I've occasionally found people that were like 23 hours ago. So I'm not really entirely sure how it's organized.
Mine is still chronological, but who knows? You're right. Yeah.
There are so many. See, this is like 2 days and now it jumps back up to 1 day.
Oh,
I don't know. It's odd. It's a fun little distraction. I will say that Christina Warren, bless her soul, told me about it on Friday. And I'm like, okay, what is this nonsense? And it feels a little bit like a Twitter Tumblr timeline
with a little Instagram thrown in. And...
Yeah, it's fun. Yeah, I enjoy the fact that you can draw with it, and it's very cheery. I don't know if I like not being able to talk directly to someone other than through Facebook like pokes. That's a little strange, but I do. I do really like. I love drawing with it. I love sending like ridiculous, ridiculous photos and GIFs. GIF engine is pretty fun.
So what's really interesting about this? It was created by Dom Hoffman, who was the Vine guy, right? He sold Vine to Twitter, co-founder of Vine. What's interesting? I mean, first of all, there's a million messaging platforms, but this isn't exactly messaging.
Not quite.
It's not exactly Twitter. It's kind of its own thing. And I think it bucks the trend in the sense that it came the Friday at the end of CES. So that's perfect timing for the tech elite to try it and get involved in it. And then I thought, really interestingly, it has a lot of hidden nooks and crannies. Like it's got unusual features that you don't immediately find. For instance, you can, if you're in the message section, you could type certain keywords. I'll type GIF. And then you can search for a animated GIF, and I'll say, I don't know, what should I say? Cakes. I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to get. And it'll search. A lot of messaging platforms, including Facebook's Messenger, will do this kind of thing where you can, and I'm just going to put that in my timeline because, wow, that's awesome. And so it's full of stuff like that. But, you know, it's also people can, you can write stuff and people can comment on it. And so there's threaded commenting as well. It's got, you could post your battery life, your ratings, the date, the time. It's got a very interesting and kind of almost eclectic set of features. Maybe it's just a flash in the pan. But on the other hand, what it really reminded me of is how anxious I am. And I think I'm not alone to get rid of Twitter. Find something better than Twitter.
I don't want to get rid of Twitter. I love Twitter.
Really?
But I mean, I've been using Twitter since 2007.
Yeah,
now,
me too.
2008.
But...
I don't know. I enjoy short form messaging. I think there's something really, really unique about it in the context of all of our other very multimedia heavy social networks. But there's the question of what does Twitter want to be? And
Yeah.
If Twitter goes anti-chronological,
10,000 characters they want
to
do, right? That's the next thing.
I want somebody to buy Twitter and give it back to the community. Like, give it, like, let the, this is not going to happen, obviously, but, you know, like, give the API back to the developers. Oh,
wouldn't that be nice?
That would be amazing. Like, if somebody wants to put, you know, their whatever, $20 billion, I can't remember how much it would take. But I have actually thought about this. Like maybe Bill Gates, right? No, he has more important stuff he's working on. somebody
curing
somebody
hunger
buy
or something.
It. Exactly. Curing malaria. and fixing schools. So somebody buy it, and there's all kinds of billionaires that waste their money on all kinds of really dumb, irrelevant things. Buy Twitter and give it back to the community.
Its market cap is $13.84 billion.
Yeah. Okay.
It's expensive.
That's like 13 Powerballs, something like
it's
that.
It's less than WhatsApp. Didn't WhatsApp end up being $22 billion?
Yeah.
Yeah, so. And it's still growing, crazy. Too. I mean, they're growing in years. So that's one thing that over Twitter, I think. I sort of have a love-hate relationship with it. It's obviously
everybody does. You're not alone.
You don't have to use. Yeah, yeah, and there are there are definitely important things that it provides. Certainly, anonymity being one of those things. I think you don't have to be a verified user. Whereas I think Facebook will move more and more in the direction of making everyone verified. And so I think there's like this. There's a part of me that likes the hacking aspect and sort of the shady aspects of Twitter, I guess, but. I just don't think that they're commercially viable. Those aren't the types of things that make you a lot of money. And I think that Twitter as a company will see that in the long run. You know, there are other use cases that are important too. Shared screen experiences or dual screen experiences, watching live TV. I'm sure the Golden Globes right now are trending.
Oh yeah, I'll be watching the Golden Globes on Twitter. Absolutely.
Yeah. And
live
so those things
is
are
some of the best part.
Live snarking. Yeah.
Live snarking. Yep. Yeah.
Okay. Live snarking. Yeah, but what's preventing Facebook from doing something like that? I mean, in reality, Facebook can update in real time. You can actually share more meaningful information because there's no character limit. And so I just don't think that you know, Twitter reminds me of Groupon in a lot of ways. It's like it was unique at the time, but now a lot of people are doing what that company is doing. It's just not it doesn't have any unique proprietary software or coding behind it. I think it's just sort of, it feels redundant to me. It feels like
it's the live internet though. I mean, the great thing about Twitter is it's the live internet.
Yeah.
It is live and you feel it. And what I really love about Twitter and what I've loved since pretty much day one, I was reflecting on this the other day where when I'm not doing tech related stuff, I do a geeky podcast with Jason Snell of Six Colors, and we do a podcast called The Incomparable, and we did one on Star Wars The Force Awakens, which, you know, that's just a recurring thing. But a couple hours after we posted it, we ended up being able to interact with people from Lucasfilm who are like, oh, yeah, we saw we listened to your podcast. We really like it. We wanted to compliment you on this. And like that's the kind of experience that you're not going to get on Facebook because of the way that the friending works. You might get like a comment or a thumbs up like from a page owner, but you don't necessarily know if that page owner is actually that person. It doesn't. Yeah. I don't know. I feel like spontaneous conversations is what I love about Twitter. That two people who have never met or don't know anything about each other can have a human conversation virtually face to face. And of course, there are some downsides to that. There's still a major harassment issue that Twitter has. But on the whole, it's a really great platform for that, for real-time messaging, for real-time interaction, for interacting with your readers, and for musicians and actors with their fans in a way that's not so
it's very informal. I mean, I would say that. I think you're right about sparking up random conversations. But, you know, outside of the media, I think that most people aren't looking to have those types of conversations. Like if you work for a company and you're using Twitter as part of your job, whether it's as a journalist or as a PR person, I think that makes complete sense. But I just don't think there's a lot of value in having people tweet at, you know, their favorite sports athlete or what, you know, any type of celebrity. I think that more meaningful interactions will be available in the near future. We already have Periscope. We already have Facebook Live. And I think interactions like that will be more meaningful than like 140 character acknowledgement of someone's fandom or like, you know, just tweeting at Kobe Bryant and saying like nice slam dunk or something like that.
I agree with you on some respects because I think that most actors and most folks in sports are not necessarily using Twitter the way that a journalist might use Twitter. But I've also seen it in two very different communities. You know, before I was in tech, I was in the webcomics community, and that's a community that's continued to thrive. And pretty much any internet-based community loves Twitter and thrives on Twitter because that's one of the major ways that you reach your fans and that you interact with your fans.
So that's a different perspective than I have. So that's a good thing to know.
Yeah. And actually a great example is, I don't know if you guys have heard of the musical Hamilton. It's kind of the hottest thing on Broadway right now, but it's
maybe ever.
The creator of Hamilton, Lin-Manuel Miranda, basically spends probably a third of his day when he's not working on his future projects or on stage interacting with people, not just like a thanks for the show, glad you liked it, but just sharing interesting behind the scenes tidbits about the show, answering questions from fans. His musical director and arranger, Alex Lacamoire, answers questions from people almost constantly, and it's a very interesting dialogue. Like, I don't follow many celebrities, true celebrities, on Twitter because, as you said, it's a very one way experience. And if you want the one way experience, you can go to Periscope, you can go to Facebook. But then there are people like Miranda or Amanda Palmer or Neil Gaiman, is another examples of like people who actually take time to interact with people, not just a like glad you liked my book, but actually, oh, I'll answer your question, or oh, you made a funny point, I will, you know, expound upon that. Meaningful conversations, not just like, you're okay.
Yeah.
Right.
My Lin-Manuel, I'm holding up my water bottle.
Have you gone? So,
No. I tried to when I
couldn't get to the show, but he has the water bottle.
I do. I've got the water bottle. I stood in line. You know, they have the lottery. I stood in line for the lottery.
Abraham.
Yeah, so it was there were probably that night 1,500 people in line for 21 tickets, you know, for the lottery, and the theater itself only seats 1,300. You know, so there were more people in line for the Ham for Ham those 21 tickets than that could have fit in the whole theater, which is that tells you how hot that show is, and it is also amazing. I mean, you can listen to the cast album, and the music is just phenomenal. It's really changing Broadway, and it's changing. I know this is not a Broadway show, but it is the way that they're using technology has been significant. The way they're using social media is particularly, I should say. They've tried to make that. They actually had a technology snafu. They tried to make Ham for Ham the ticket lottery
digital.
Yeah, and it crashed.
And it failed.
Yeah, so they had to go back to
manual. 50,000 people applied for the lottery, and this is just one day's lottery, mind you. This is, and the only people who can apply are people who live basically within city limits who can get to the theater within an hour of the lottery drawing. 50,000 people, and it crashed the Broadway system because they'd never seen that happen before. And immediately, Miranda et al. Are kind of like, well, so we're going to go back to the other system while we fix this, but eventually we'll like to go digital for the winter because it's cold outside.
Yeah, because they do a little, they know that people can't all come to see it, so they do a little 5-minute performance for you. And they know that most people won't get to see the show, and so they come out and they do a little, and then somebody YouTubes it every time, and then Lin-Manuel Miranda retweets it, whoever, you know, the best sort of YouTube version.
Yeah,
of
Howard Sherman, who works across the street from the Richard Rogers, comes out of his office building and is friends with Miranda, and he comes down and videotapes it pretty much every night. Those are crazy. Awesome. And those originated on social, like those wouldn't exist except for the fact that Miranda tweeted before the very first night of previews, hey, oh my God, there's so many people here. We're just going to do a little thing because, hey, there are like 300 of you here and not all of you are going to be able to get out to the show. They're so cool. Like it's such a neat way of incorporating social media into a Broadway performance.
Totally. And the Ham for Ham performances
are
amazing.
Yeah, but look at where the reference video is from and look at where they're posting these things to. You know,
Instagram.
Yeah, exactly. They're uploading the video onto YouTube or Instagram and then retweeting on Twitter. So I just don't think it's like ultimately that great of a broadcast network. And I think even for things like live tweeting events, there will be better versions available in the near future when our TVs get smarter and when our homes are more connected. I just don't think the user interface is that great. And so, you know, I do like informal discussion, but I guess I don't think that Twitter has figured out how to present the most meaningful information at the right times. And part of that has to do with their commitment to reverse chronological, the waterfall of information. But I'm a little bit skeptical about Twitter's future. I just don't think that they're doing enough to stay relevant, and certainly not doing enough to make to make their investors happy and make money.
It's so interesting. I totally love your idea, Jason, of let's just buy it back and open it up and bring back the API. Because that's how Twitter got there. It really, and Jack Dorsey, come on, that's all you have to do. And I understand it's tough when you're a publicly held company because the shareholders are going to get peeved. But I think that is the only solution that makes any sense is let its users determine its future.
Yeah, it's so fundamental. It's like the dial. I love the metaphor. It's like the dial tone of the internet, right? Yeah. It is the live internet, and it's not that it shouldn't have some product behind it, but it, like, if anything was meant to be open sourced, it's almost like this thing, I think, could just thrive and do the kind of things that you know, that we're talking about. It does need to change, and it does need to adapt, and it does need to get better. And as you know, other interfaces and mobile and things, you know, become more a part of the user experience, that needs to be part of it too. So I think the community could do it better than one company.
Absolutely. Well, the funny thing to me always about Twitter is I don't understand why they're not doing more with their potential analytics in terms of they have access to all of this public information. You know, it's Facebook, you have privacy settings and you have a vast number of privacy settings because you share a lot of information on Facebook. Twitter, I think there's a gold mine of information on that service that I know that Twitter does sell some of their fire hose to various services, but I don't understand why they are not the 21st century Nielsen, where they're like,
oh my God,
they have so much data on television, on movies, on musicals, on shows. The fact that they haven't figured out, they haven't gotten some really, really smart numbers people and be like, let's build a program that essentially can sell all of this data, to people.
This is an example of why a privately held or even a publicly held company, actually especially a publicly held company, maybe isn't the best steward for something like this. This should be a public service. Because if you had an API and you gave the firehose to anybody who wanted it, somebody would build that.
Lots of people would probably build it. There'd be all kinds of different things, you know, sentiment analysis. I mean, people are doing some of it now, but the kind of
Let's nationalize Twitter. Let's just nationalize it. Just take
there's
it
your,
over.
There's
let's
your
not,
title.
Let's not turn it political.
Well, but you know what? I think that's the solution. You can't. And I don't see another company buying it as a solution. I think it's to be a public. I think it's a utility. It's a public utility. It's like the dial tone. That's such an obvious correct thing to do.
Like, what would it take?
What would it take?
I wouldn't rule out Jack Dorsey opening up the API, honestly, because there have been talks about it in the last year or so, rumors mostly. But I wouldn't. Twitter has taken a very big about face in terms of the way that it interacts with developers in the last year. And I'm kind of hoping that eventually means
they're going to have to really step out, though, because developers have been so burned by it that they've really got to convince them that this is a genuine move.
That would be so gangster if he did that, though, if he just said, you know what, we're going to open this thing up and we're going to make it, we're going to become a platform again, and we're going to build stuff on top of it, and we're going to invite everybody else to build stuff, to build their own sentiment analysis, to build their own applications.
Doesn't that make it more valuable for the shareholders,
ultimately? I think that
ultimately
makes it infinitely more valuable. Yeah. Infinitely more valuable.
Well, you would think I mean, it's definitely a big assumption to say that, like, it will for sure make the company more money. But I don't think it's a far reach to say that Jack Dorsey would, you know, potentially open these things up. I mean, he's been a big advocate for the programmers and developers in the past. Certainly that's where his background is.
It was Dick Costolo who shut down the third parties, right?
The founders of that company to even agree on a single idea, I think, has been, at least from my understanding, a huge pain over the course of Twitter's lifetime. And so, you know, it's no shock to me that Twitter's having an identity crisis at this moment in time. And I mean, you know, Jason, you've made a great point. The more open that Twitter has been in the past, the more successful and at least more the more that I've been able to get out of it. And I think that that would make it way more attractive to me. And I think to more people. But you really just never know with these publicly traded companies. I mean, you know, consider MySpace and some of the discussions that probably happened around that after it went public. I mean, that thing tanked pretty fast. And you know, I would say that Twitter doesn't seem to be all that much different.
It's an interesting, politically, though, it is very interesting because increasingly social networks are more than a private company. They're really about they're the social common ground, the commons. And they really should be treated as the commons, because no one entity, one business entity, should control them.
Remember when the Iranian, when there was those protests in Iran and the U.S. government went to, and Twitter was about to run a some kind of maintenance.
And the U.S. government
went to them. Several governments went to them and said, please do not. They're like, you cannot do this. This is one of the few ways that people and activists inside have to communicate with the outside world, because so much of communication is being shut down. I mean, I think that was the moment that we all realize this thing is way bigger than what we originally
The kinds of steps Jack is taking so far, like the maybe increasing to 10,000 characters, that's not what we were looking for. What you were looking for is a wide open API and a fire hose that's available. Now, I understand the problem with having the fire hose available, that's the full stream, is that's expensive. Yeah. But I'm sure you could get, you know, support to making that totally available, or just charge people for access, charge them a reasonable fee for access. Because there's so much value in that.
Yeah, charge them for the amount of data that they use or something. Yeah. I mean,
again, treat it like a utility.
Yeah, it's like a dumb pipe. And that's what the argument that they'll say is, that that's a dumb pipe, right?
Right. But
there's lots of dumb pipes that make a lot of money.
Dumb pipe's good. Dumb pipe is how you get innovation, because then it's a platform,
people build on top of it.
Now, what about Facebook? Let's talk about Facebook. You know, all the growth. And okay, so I'm, by the way, now deleting Peach, because that's not going to go anywhere. But but Peach is trying to do is kind of conflate Twitter and messaging. And it's very clear that messaging is a very important platform. Mm-hmm. But I feel like Facebook is going to own this. There's not much we can do about it at this point. Am I wrong?
Man.
I'd love to see
so many of the users, you know, they're just, they kind of.
Well, and that's critical with messaging, right? You don't want to, I used this analogy a couple of weeks ago. You don't want to buy a phone that can only call 10% of the populace. You want a messaging platform that speaks to everybody, if possible. There isn't such a thing yet, but Facebook is the closest.
I held out on Facebook Messenger for a long time.
Me too.
Finally, people kept messaging me, and then I was tired of opening up the browser on my phone. So finally, I was like, I forget it, you know, and I gave in.
I don't want to give in. And Facebook, like Twitter, you love to hate. It's another one of those.
It's such a pain. It's such a pain to have different apps for.
Right. Don't we want one app?
It is.
Yeah. I Facebook in general frustrates me on a number of levels. I almost left about 4 years ago and then got sucked back because of roller derby. And I'm still kind of, it's just.
Facebook. Because roller derby.
I have no, Facebook because roller derby. I have no concrete things to say except, ugh, because that's how
everybody feels that way.
Yeah,
but because everybody you know, including your family, is there, you have to use it.
It's the AOL of 2010.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, it's totally AOL.
Yeah, and for that reason, I would say it doesn't irritate me as much as the normal person. I actually openly embrace Facebook. I mean, it's not going anywhere anytime soon. Sure, they know a lot of information about me, but like, so does Google.
Yeah, who cares about that? I'm not worried about that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Facebook provides a greater utility for me than any piece of software that I use on a daily basis. I mean, Facebook, to some extent, is more meaningful than my Gmail account. I think, sure, I get a lot of work done via email, but Facebook is showing me the perspective of a lot of thousands of people from around the world I've met over the course of my lifetime, and allows me to interact with those people immediately, instantaneously about any subject. And so, I think they're the clear winner in this case, and they're still growing financially and also from a user perspective. And the fact that they bought WhatsApp and Instagram in the past few years, and those two services are still growing, makes it hugely attractive to me. And also, to further this point, I think that Zuckerberg has done a really great job of clearing his name. I think for a long time, people considered him a really awkward, nerdy, an opportunist, even to a certain extent after The Social Network, the movie, was released. But in the past year, maybe year and a half, I think Zuckerberg has done a great job of sharing more of his personal life with people on Facebook and introducing them to things like the moment he vaccinated his daughter within the past week.
Wow.
Or taking paternity leave in North Korea, 360-degree video. I mean,
right.
He is one of the smartest people in the world at this moment in time. He's certainly one of the richest. And I'm excited to see how he matures as an individual. I think, you know, he is the Bill Gates of our time. He is he has made humanitarian issues a really big part of his life, and I think he's building a service that people need to use, and the people that refuse to use it are ultimately going to fall behind. I think that it's, you know, a disservice to them, and I think it says more about their either self-confidence or their ability to embrace these things more so than it does about, you know, what is doing to society. You know, Facebook is connecting more people than ever before, and I don't see how that could possibly be a bad thing. I think when you talk about sharing ideas quickly and that sort of thing, yeah, sure, a lot of that happens on Twitter because it's informal and people use anonymous names and that thing, but I think slowly we'll all make our way over to Facebook. It seems really obvious to me everything that Facebook is doing. No, not at all. I mean, I think it's something that they declared years ago. You're trying to get rid of email by having everyone move over to messages. And I think to a certain extent, they're right to pursue that. I don't see anything wrong with it. It's in layman's terms, it's sort of like the phone book, I guess, of the modern era. But with more capabilities, you can send videos and GIFs and photos and any type of media that you can imagine, and it's all in one place, and to me that's hugely important. I mean, I'm not going there for creative inspiration necessarily, but I am going there for like meaningful interactions with my family and friends from around the world, and I would personally pay a huge premium for that, and I think people have shown that they will in the past too, and so I think Facebook is uniquely positioned because they're gathering so much information about different people. They've certainly invested in a lot of interesting categories over the past couple of years, and I think they've done a great job of making people fear Facebook less, making people fear the security issues and sign
up. You know, they made it more mobile.
And even the news feed is better. I mean, frankly, maybe it's me using it more or whatever, but I actually started to like the news feed.
I don't love Facebook. Terrible. I do think it's difficult terrible. To use, especially to try to, you know, their settings are just so convoluted.
Oh, it's gotten worse.
I think that's terrible. I don't think it's a great user experience, but I think I do agree. So many people are there that that's the only thing it really has. I think that's what it's got going for it the most. I do think that the biggest thing they've done over the last couple of years is they went mobile. I thought they were dead. They were dead if they hadn't gone mobile. But two most impressive things they ever did in my mind, one was their shift to mobile. Recently they did it in a very short period of time to where most people I know now use it on mobile. But the first thing they did and what made Facebook is it was always up. Social networks in the late 2000s, mid to late 2000s, as you guys remember, they were just a pain. They were slow. Twitter especially was down all the time. It didn't work. I think what made Facebook was that they had an amazing engineering culture that created a product that was always up. You could always go there and you could get your stuff posted. You get your photos uploaded because it was primarily a photo. For the longest time, it was just a photo sharing and gaming site. And still primarily that's what it is. But that's why Facebook, I think, is what it is. And that does bode well for their future, and that technologically, they also, the reason why they're successful now as a public company is they understand data much, much better than Twitter does. And they understand how to monetize data, and they are a better platform. It's kind of dirty that they've made small businesses and brands pretty much disappear from the feed unless you pay to do it. But when you pay, it actually works, and they show you great analytics on it.
Gives me a better experience, though. I don't want to see all those businesses and brands, even if I'm
Well, that's true. Yeah. I mean, but at the same time, why don't they let you decide that, you know?
Right.
Yeah, but I guess what bothers me is that, you know, I hear about a lot of different people championing big data and the importance of artificial intelligence and a number of these things. And Facebook is the company that's doing that at the best. It's between Facebook and Google.
Oh, yeah. So, I'm agreeing. So, I mean, you know, I'm agreeing.
Google's predictive search is obviously super helpful, and a lot of the things that they're doing with Google.com and bringing that information to you much more quickly. But I would say close behind is Facebook. And actually, they know quite a bit about everyone that they know more about you and your friends than probably you do. And so, you know, the fact that they killed reverse chronological order and now the newsfeed just promotes what they think you would want to see, I think that's a huge step toward where we need to be. And that actually is advantageous over Twitter, which is frankly, hard to sort through.
Agreed. That's why they're winning as a public company, because they understand the value of that data and they're using it very well. And they're making a lot of money because of that. They're printing money. They're printing money because of that, in the same way that Google was printing money when it first started AdSense. And that's, you know, why they are becoming, that's why they are making so much money and why they are able to buy, you know, all of these companies. And so, they are a force to be reckoned with because of that. I absolutely agree.
Let's take a break. We have more coming up with our great panel and lots more to talk about. Renee Ritchie is not here. I was looking at Facebook and I saw a post from Renee. Apparently Apple's updated. I'm sorry. But also from mymore.com, Serenity Caldwell is here. Renee's with us in spirit. He's always here. He's
always
kind of the ghost in the machine. Also from Popular Science, Michael Nunez, thank you for being here. And Jason Heiner from CBS Interactive and Editor-in-Chief of the Tech Republic. We had a great week. My first week back. And here's a little bit of what you might have missed if you missed anything this week on Twit.
Previously on Twit.
I want to move on to something else that you said you saw called insertable wearables. Was that a joke or a real thing?
So the Internet of Things now includes the Internet of Insertable Things.
Boy.
It's just like it sounds. Mm. It's just like it sounds, man.
Oh, really? I'm so glad I asked you about that. Thank you.
Twit Live Specials.
Once a year, the tech world gathers in Las Vegas, Nevada for, well, the most important event on the calendar. It's the Consumer Electronics Show. Actually, now it's just called CES. I'm Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit for Twit TV, with a behind-the-scenes look at the gadgets of CES.
This Week in Google.
Hey, what do you guys think about 10,000-character tweets coming soon to a Twitter near you?
Weird, weird, weird. It becomes a publishing platform. So now you'll be spending more time with less stuff, so that less stuff has to resonate.
Tech News Today.
The new Tech News Today, the show where we talk about technology with people who are passionate about technology.
We saved a spot at the front of the head of the table just
for
you.
Thank you.
I thought this would feel comfortable for you.
Twit. Friends don't let friends miss Twit.
Got a great week ahead for you. In fact, tomorrow it's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to talk to photographer Vince LaForêt. He has just published a new book called The Air Book. Beautiful, incredible photos of cities from the air. He's a filmmaker. First guy I met who used the Canon 5D for films. He's really a great photographer. He'll be joining us tomorrow on Triangulation. Our show today brought to you by Stamps.com. If you are sending stuff, whether you're an eBay seller, Amazon seller, maybe you sell on Etsy, and you're still licking and gluing stamps to the package or carrying them down to the post office, I've got a better way. Every minute of your time is valuable. Every dollar for your small business is important. And Stamps.com takes advantage of that to make you more efficient. You can do everything you could do at the post office without getting up from your desk, including buying and printing U.S. postage from your computer, your printer. You do not need an expensive postage meter. You don't have to drive to the post office. The mail carrier comes to you, and it makes your packages look more professional. You can even print your logo on it, prints on letters, any class of mail. Prints beautiful labels with your logo, your return address. It can auto-fill your recipient's address from your website. automatically fill out international customs forms, certified mail, return receipt. You even get discounts at Stamps.com that you can't get at the post office on package insurance and other things. You can use Costco's to track your postage spending by customer. It takes your address book. Here's the deal. Look, you got to try it. It's the best thing to do. Just go to Stamps.com. Stamps.com. Easy to remember, right? And you click the microphone that's up in the upper right-hand corner. And that's if it says, you know, heard you on a radio or podcast. And then put TWIT, just TWIT as the offer code. What you're going to get is a four-week trial of Stamps.com, but a lot more. You get a $110 bonus offer, including $55 in postage coupons that you can use in the first few months of your Stamps.com membership. You get a digital scale you can use so you never have – you always have the right postage. You never have to put extra on or accidentally put too little on. That's a bad way to send stuff out. No, scale is phenomenal. Plus a $5 supply kit and, again, a four-week trial. Stamps.com. Click the radio microphone in the upper right-hand corner and use the promo code TWIT to try it free today. Stamps.com. Jason Heiner is the author of a book in which I appear. It's the closest thing I will ever get to a biography.
I don't know about
FollowTheGeeksBook.com, and it's finally coming out.
Yes. January 26th is the release date. It will be on Kindle. It will be on Audible. Dan Patterson is reading the audiobook.
Oh, nice.
Phenomenal job. Great. Yes. It will also be in soft cover from Amazon, and we also have a hardcover version as well. You can pre-order on our site now. It was so fun to do this, and Lindsay Gilpin is my co-author, and she and I just interviewed some of the smartest people we know.
Aratunde.
Lisa Bettany.
Love Lisa Bettany. Gina Trapani. Tom Merritt. I mean, everybody, Veronica Belmont, O'Malik, this is so great, Chase Jarvis. These are people I love. Some people you might not have heard of, like Juliana Rotich.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
She's great. Ushahidi, founder. I'm in it. And the last one I love,
yeah,
it's a 15-year-old entrepreneur named Maya Penn.
Who's just phenomenal. I mean, she started her own company when she was 8.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, coded her own site, was building her own computers, and then started a company where she was making her own clothing line with organics. Anyway, all these people are just amazing. Leo, you know, people like you that were so generous with your time with us to talk about your story. And it really is about the future of work is a lot more entrepreneurial and is a lot, whether you're in a big company, you know, even in big companies, people are working in smaller groups and having to be more entrepreneurial with their own groups. And so the book is really about the future of work and people that have figured out some of the secrets. And, you know, we took their stories and all people that we wanted to learn from and we put them in, you know, wrote a chapter about 10 really great folks. And so, I'm really thrilled that it's almost here.
You've been working on it a year, haven't you?
Yeah, really a year and a half. We started in June 2014, and so but we released all the chapters.
Whoa, I didn't know that. Wow, more than a year. Yeah.
We released all the chapters one at a time as we published them on the internet, with the idea that you know, we would get great feedback from the community, the technology community, and we did, and that made every chapter better. And then at the end of the final version of the book, we have some of the best comments from the community. We've published some of the best comments about each of these.
Oh, that's great.
Votes. And so that makes it fun.
FollowTheGeeksBook.com. And it's time to pre-order because it comes out January 26th.
Yes, indeed.
Serenity Caldwell, what are you working on at iMore these days?
Oh, gosh. We actually just published a big thing called The State of iMore 2016. We're going to be doing a lot of really exciting stuff with the site. Renee and I and Georgia and a couple other special guests are going to be working on something called iMore Select, working title, which hopefully allows us, we're going to try and build a place where we can present our more long form feature articles, hopefully with fewer or no ads, which we're pretty excited about.
Wow.
So we're working on the sort of the mechanics to get that into place. But we're also launching a couple of cool new columns, including a help and how-to column for getting some Mac and iOS 101 stuff out the door.
I love the 101 stuff and the help stuff you do. I actually read it all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like it's really important. And I've gotten this comment more than a couple of my friends in wildly different areas are like, you know, I Googled for this random thing and I ended up finding an article.
Always.
You wrote.
Yes.
Which is so funny. But yeah, the last thing we're working on at iMore, we're doing a thing called iMore Pop. Which is basically Renee's joke is all of the apps that Serenity and I don't play because we're busy you know, watching Star Wars for a fifth time. So we're gonna have a couple of contributors come on and write about the Kimojis and the, you know, the Crossy Roads and all of the crazy games and,
oh, fun.
And little poppy things, Snapchat, that we just don't have time to do because we're doing all of the other
stuff. You have found a great home. I am so glad after you left Macworld that you went to iMore.
Me too.
I was mad at first because I wanted to steal you, but I think that this is really the place for you. I think you found a great home.
It would have been hard for me to work for you from across the country.
Yeah.
So
no, but whereas it's easy with iMore. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And yeah, and then I still get to be on Twitter.
Yay! Again. Yeah. We get our share of Serenity. So thank you.
Of course.
Here. Michael Nunez, Popular Science. We met because you wrote a piece and interviewed me for it. And I said, Michael, you're great. We ought to get you on Twit sometime.
Yeah, that's right. And thanks for doing that, by the way. So that'll be available to everyone in our March and April issue. It's a double issue. And on the cover will be someone that everyone knows. He's a great leader. I don't think that I can mention him by name at this point. But we're all very excited about this cover. And and then in terms of just what I'm working on at PopSci, so we're getting that issue ready. We've just come back from CES, and I'll actually be joining Gizmodo next week. So this is breaking news, I guess, in that sense. But I'll be the new technology editor of Gizmodo.
Oh, you got a new job?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
What the hell?
So, yeah, I haven't really announced that.
Congratulations. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool. It's really exciting.
Going to work for the AOL.
No, not for AOL.
No, they're Gawker. They're Gawker.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're owned by Gawker. Yeah.
That's
so,
right. Gadgets.
That's really cool. Yeah. We'll be
congratulations.
Just doing a lot of new stuff over there. And so you know, I still have a lot of friends at Popular Science and I'm still working on some things over the course of the next week. But yeah, that transition has basically begun and CES was sort of where some of that started. So, yeah, all really exciting things.
No wonder you like CES. I went to CES and I got a new job.
I mean, some of those arrangements were, you know, sorted out before the conference.
That's great.
But yeah, it's just been,
that'll be fun.
It's just been a blast. And this time of year, it's been really, really exciting for me. So
good. Well, and I hear Gizmodo gets invited to Apple events again. So that's good too.
Yeah. And hopefully, you know, hopefully a lot more people will see just what we're working on a day-to-day basis. Good. You know, I've been fortunate enough to do a lot of TV in the past year, and I think we're hoping to continue a lot of those relationships. So I would say that the mission statement's like pretty closely aligned with Popular Science. You know, we're really excited about the future. We focus on drones, robots, cars, and gadgets. And you know, I think there's just a healthy amount of skepticism at Gizmodo, and there are a few different types of stories that we can write there that I'm just unable to write at Popular Science. So there'll be a little
Congrats.
More freedom and yeah, it'll be cool. I'm excited.
Serenity just wrote an interesting article on iMore. Of course, one of the big stories in the Apple world is the rumor that is growing stronger and stronger that Apple's going to abandon a headphone port in the next iPhone. They just won't be there. Is that because they want you to use the Lightning port, or do they expect all headphones to be wireless going forward?
No, I think it's a combination of a couple different factors. Taking away the headphone jack allows them a little bit more space for battery, as well as for a slight reshaping of the case. The Lightning port, you know, isn't that much bigger, or the headphone jack isn't that much bigger.
It's not
than
like
the
it's
going
to, it's not just to make it thinner, I hope.
No, but the point is that it goes into the device. So it's actually, you know, of my 6S Plus here, the headphone jack has taken up probably about that much space.
Oh, interesting.
On the interior of it. So that's all space, especially with drivers, that Apple could be.
There's already a petition, many, many signers saying, don't take the headphone jack out. 200,000 people.
No, you know what? I'm okay with this. I'm normally anti-port removal for Apple. The new MacBook is not a computer that I'm going to buy anytime soon.
Really? Yeah.
But for the 6S Plus, I actually think it makes a lot of sense. Or the 6S Plus. For the future generation of iPhone, it makes a lot of sense. For one thing, the Lightning connector offers a serious amount of power inherent in it. And I think that if you want to talk about wired headphones, there might be a way to make the sound quality better by going via Lightning. And I know some analog traditional headphones users will be like, that's fie on you, Serenity Caldwell. That's horrible.
Oh, yeah. But I have to say, you could if by taking the DAC out of the iPhone and having an external DAC, because the Lightning port will give you digital audio, you could really improve it. If you have expensive headphones, this is actually a good move for you. You're listening to a kind of a not so great DAC in the iPhone. Yeah,
absolutely. And there are a lot of things that they can do with this, you know, that it encourages the adoption of wireless headphones, which, you know what, I'm wearing cheapo wired headphones right now, but I actually recently bought my first pair of like really good wireless headphones. And I'm, you know, even with Bluetooth not being the best connection in the world, it's incredible. I did not expect to enjoy the wireless headphone life as much as I am, and I'm like, how did I ever deal with this cord being attached to my world?
I'm jealous. But, yeah. I'm jealous. Yeah, I wouldn't want to do that too.
Do you want anybody going to buy these Braggy Dash in ear Bluetooth tiny little?
Oh, man, they're definitely attractive. Yeah, I mean, I think.
Did you see them at CES? I guess they're shipping now.
Yeah, they were there. I didn't see them. I've seen things like them from other companies that have gone unreleased. But I mean, these wireless earbuds are definitely coming, whether they're from Braggy or any other company. And I think for anyone that goes to the gym, it's like a no-brainer. I mean, you just don't want, you know, there are Bluetooth wireless headsets that that require you to wear like a necklace or they're wired together in the back.
Stuff.
But how much battery life can these have? They're so small.
These only have 5 hours, and then they come with a little charging case that
five's
I guess charges
so
them up. Yeah, yeah, five's decent for a work. You know, it's not like one and a half.
Right.
My main thing with the Braggy, I think it's a really interesting proof of concept, and I love that their little case is also a charger. Because that's a way to
Motorola did that. Motorola did that with their little earbud, their Bluetooth earbud, and that worked very well. I've been using that; it works well.
Yeah, it's interesting. But the thing about the Braggy that intrigued me, and I actually got tipped off to this by a reader on Twitter, is again the idea that it has a built-in music player. It doesn't need to connect to your phone.
Oh, it has memory.
Yeah, it has 4 gigabytes of memory, so you can actually put in your stuff. So I was talking, you know, completely unrelatedly on the iMore show. We were talking about the future of the iPod, and I was joking, you know, if they're going to, you know, I originally last year thought the future of the iPod was the Apple Watch because that's, you know, it's wearables. But what better place to wear an iPod than actually in your headphones?
Interesting.
So I don't know. I wrote this article and I'm like, there's some pros and some cons to this and battery life.
Well, Apple owns Beats headphones.
They do. They do.
So they're positioned to do something like this.
Exactly. You can enjoy my really poorly drawn illustration.
Is that me ringing? Is my phone ringing?
I thought that was me. I was like, oh my goodness.
Okay. I think somebody else. It's not me. there's your problem, the headphone. So I think, no, that's a very interesting idea. I mean, Apple's not selling many iPods anyway. Everybody's got a smartphone with music on it.
Well, exactly. So the only really for the iPod to have any kind of future, I feel like it has to be wearable in a way, because the people who are still using iPods for iPods are runners and people with huge
athletes.
Music collections who want to take their music collection and, you know, either listen to
it in the
car.
If you have an Apple Watch and unwired headphones, you can already do that. Apple Watch stores
music. You can,
music.
But it's just one playlist's worth.
Oh.
So it's essentially 24, you know, it's 75.
Well, the good news is, isn't there a new Apple Watch coming out in 2 months?
There theoretically is.
Just right.
We'll see how much more space they can cram into this tiny little thing.
Yeah.
I prefer more battery than more space, but we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I don't mind. As long as I get through the day, my Apple Watch gets me through the day very easily.
Yeah. Are you on the 42 or the 38?
Oh, you have a 38.
I'm on
the 38.
I have a 42.
The 38 gets me close. Yeah, the 38 gets me close if I'm not working out heavily.
I buy Big Apple everything. I have the 6S Plus. I have the 42-inch watch because I want battery life. Wow, these Proggies are $300.
What are you using this Apple Watch for? I mean, I'm still, you know, I've tried just about every smartwatch on the planet, and I can't, I wouldn't dare replace any of the analog mechanical watches that I have. I mean, they're just like way nicer. They look way cooler. And I haven't found either the killer app or the killer feature on any of the smartwatches.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
So what's the point, I guess, is my question to all of you.
People were thinking that the Apple Watch was a computer on your wrist when it's actually just a slightly smarter Fitbit.
That's right. That's about right.
Yeah. No, I mean, what I enjoy, for one thing, I'm not an analog watch wearer, and I haven't been since I was about 12. So having the Apple Watch on my wrist actually fulfilled the, like, oh, I have a watch again. That's nice. Mm. The big things for me, and I'm going to write something on iMore about this. The big things for me almost a year into my Apple Watch ownership is the fitness tracking is hugely important. There's an app called Heart Aware on the iPhone now that's, I think, like $1 or $2. That's fascinating. It takes all of your Apple Watch data and it's able to show you averages and all sorts of things with your heart. And if you're interested in exercising or if you're someone who needs to keep track of their heartbeat for medical reasons, that's a really cool way.
But isn't it true that the heart rate sensor in the Apple Watch is actually inaccurate? And
no, I found it to be very accurate.
It's
really,
I am on a treadmill and I have, handles that will measure my heart rate, which is very accurate. And it almost always is exactly the same within a beat or two of my Apple Watch.
Okay.
So I found it to be very accurate, at least for me.
Was that app called Serenity?
Heart Aware. Yeah, I found out about it from Federico Vitici over at Mac Stories. It's pretty neat. The heartbeat sensor will malfunction for me occasionally, but I'd say it's accurate probably 90-96% of the time, which is better.
I'm guessing Michael's got tattoos all over his wrists.
No, I don't.
Your boyfriend doesn't he, Serenity? And it,
yeah, my fiance.
I'm sorry. Fiance.
Oh, I know.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations. I saw it on Facebook. That's how I know.
Ah, see there, Facebook, the great unifier. But aside from the heart rate, what I've been really using it for, I still use it for notification deference, where when I'm out, leave my phone in the bag. And that's really, really nice. As somebody who gets a lot of emails and a lot of texts and a lot of like things that are important for me, it's very easy for me to glance down and be like, message from Renee. Okay, it's about Star Wars. It can wait until after I'm finished eating or something like that. It's not the site is burning down. We need you right this second. The other thing that I really like is with watchOS 2 and complications, third-party complications have basically become my lifeblood. I don't know if I can really, I'm going to try and show it upside down here. I have Carrot Weather on here as a complication.
The snotty weather app.
Yeah, super snarky. It's like, it's fracking sunny. Go wear some sunglasses. I like instant weather glances. I like the fact there's an app called Just Press Record that has a complication.
Oh.
So essentially, this will record voice memos.
Oh.
Watch at any time.
I
have an idea while driving, all I have to do is press the complication and it immediately brings up that and starts recording.
I'm going to get that.
So that I can.
That sounds good.
Yeah. That's one of my favorite Apple Watch apps and it's built for the watch. So unlike every other watch app, which is like loading, it loads instantly.
Oh, that's good.
What's that called? And stores Just Press Record.
Just Press Record. Okay.
Just Press Record.
It's great. It's one of the few.
It'd be good for any apps. Journalist, right?
Yeah.
It's very.
Hey, El Chapo. Tell me, what's your plans for the future are?
Right.
See, if only, what's his name? Sean Penn had one of those. How about this? This was at CES, the Owlet Smart Sock. See, I'm waiting. I think that the smartwatch, I'll be much more interested in take my blood sugar, my oxygen, when it can really tell me, you know, it can get some good, important numbers. Then it's going to be hugely valuable. This is kind of interesting. This is a sock that monitors your baby's heart rate and oxygen level and can tell you, warn you on your smartphone if your baby's in trouble.
Yeah, baby tech and senior tech.
Huge.
Was really huge at CES this year.
Everybody's one or the other at some point. Maybe both if you're lucky.
I will say the worst baby tech story that I saw was an intravaginal music player for the expecting mother.
No,
yeah.
Play
music in the womb.
And No.
What? Just put it on the belly, like they can hear.
Exactly. Put the headphones. This is not a problem that needed solving.
Honey,
smart.
Is your
pregnancy test?
Is your thing singing?
Yeah, need to play some lullabies. No, I think that you're right, Leo. Like the health and wellness, you know, what I found is
that's what we need.
The health and wellness category as a whole is sort of ripe for the taking. There's going to be a lot of growth in health and wellness over the course of the next 10 to 20 years. I mean, we talk
as we age.
Absolutely. People want boomers to know more about their health. I mean, I think any well-educated person wants to know how healthy they are and basically, you know, how their body's holding up over the course of time and what they can do to be better about that. And whether it's eating better or exercising smarter. And
about the Under Armour, smart clothing that they were doing?
I've written a bit about some of this embedded technology.
Yeah.
I think Project Jacquard is another one from Google.
That's from Google.
And a lot of that stuff is great. But like you said, you know, it's just about who's providing the most helpful information. And, you know, what I found with basically a large majority of the wearables market is that there's redundancy across the board. So the Apple Watch doesn't seem to be doing anything that even the Fitbit Blaze, which is, a total piece of vaporware,
which I still can't cancel.
Unfortunately don't run that. It's just silly to me to see how much redundancy there is across the board. And that's the one thing I'll give Under Armour with this health box. You know, they've at least packaged all of this stuff together in one big box so that you can get it all at once. But for the most part, they're all doing the same thing. They're all using accelerometers to count your steps and pulse oximetry
It's a market it's a nascent market, which at some point will really become important, but at this point it's not.
Well, the differentiator will be the data, right? The data is going to be, Under Armour is going to be really interesting because they have this data processing monster on the back end, right? And data is going to change health and medicine immensely over the next couple of decades. We're going to look back in 30 years from now and think like, oh my God, like we barely knew anything. We were, treating all these things. We were just throwing crap at the wall to see what would stick.
And
because this is going to lead to the era of personalized medicine, right? We're seeing that already. The data is going to enable medicines to be able to be customized for you and treatments to be customized for you based on how your body reacts to medicines and to exercise and to food.
Forget smart cars. Things. Let's get that going. Would you please?
Yes.
I totally agree. I mean, right now, these gadgets can tell you like how many steps you've taken.
Yeah. They're fancy pedometers. Yeah.
Yeah. And those two things are helpful. Certainly, it's better to know those things than to not know them. But like you said, there's so many other pieces of biometric information that they can be feeding you. And right now they can't. And a lot of the technology is available in hospitals. And so there's going to be this weird trickle down effect where the things that are available in hospitals will slowly reach consumers.
Right.
And as they do, we'll live healthier and longer lives. And, I just don't think that the Apple Watch is going to present that either in its first iteration or next year or in 2016's iteration. I don't think that I've seen really any consumer electronics that can really provide that level of detail.
Reasons, including FDA approval and just the lack of capability. And hey, we got to take a break. We want to wrap this up, but I have one more bit. I want to yell at John Ledger. But first, a word from Audible.com. Then I shall rant. Our show brought to you by the company of all the advertisers we have. I've been using the longest since 2000. I am an Audible lover. I have been since I had a long commute and I discovered audiobooks and I was renting boxes of cassettes. And then along comes Audible. My life changed for the better. Now, today, 180,000 titles rich. Books, but also performances and lectures. And by the way, the great courses are on Audible now. You can listen to the best college lecturers on every subject. I am a huge fan. We're going to get you two books for free. I'm almost embarrassed to admit that one of the books I'm reading right now is that book by Marie Kondo on tidying up. The life-changing magic of tidying up, the Japanese art of decluttering and organizing. No Snickers from the peanut gallery, huh? Okay.
Well, no, I think I've heard of this book.
So yeah, it's huge.
You ask yourself whether each object in your home brings you happiness.
Does it spark joy? And I plan to get rid of everything that doesn't spark joy. So we're going to be having a massive garage sale very soon. But I also listen to a lot of science fiction. I'm now listening to Neal Stephenson's latest Seven Eves and loving it. It's hard science fiction, but it's in the sense of, you know, great science. They've gone back and recorded some of the classic science fiction books of all time. Oh, here's one of my favorite audiobooks of all time, Angela's Ashes by Frank McCourt, one of the classics. And Frank McCourt reads it in his beautiful Irish accent. It's a tragic tale, but it's his life, and it comes to life in his narration. That's one of the things that I love about Audible books. The readers make this, it's not somebody reading a boring, but it is a performance. And if you haven't, you may have seen The Martian in the theaters. If you haven't listened to R.C. Bray bring The Martian to life and Mark Watney's incredible story, you'll love this too. There's so many great books. Here's the deal. You're going to get two books for free. You'll be going to audible.com/twit2, audible.com/twit and the number 2. You're going to choose two books. Basically, you're signing up for the Platinum account. That's a 2 books a month account. It also includes the Daily Digest of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. I hear this would be a good one, too. The Star Wars novelization of The Force Awakens, I'm told, is excellent. Really well done. And this is kind of a dramatization, I think. It comes to life as you're listening. I'll play a little bit of this. Audible.com/twit and the number 2.
And in response, the figure of Kylo Ren turned and looked sideways directly at the soldier.
Okay, enough. No spoilers.
The music!
It's building! I love this. Audible.com/twit2. I'll tell you what, whether it's a commute, a boring hour on a treadmill, walking the dog, doing the dishes, or tidying up your home, there's nothing like having an audiobook. And by the way, if you have an Amazon Echo, you can have it read to you, and I do that all the time, too. Audible.com/twit2. You will love it. All right, so a little John Ledger action. I think John Ledger, the CEO of T-Mobile, has taken a page from the book of Donald Trump. He's realized if you're going to make something up, say it loud. Yell, a little profanity wouldn't hurt. The Electronic Frontier Foundation starts this story by talking about T-Mobile's new Binge On service, saying, hey, guess what? Binge On doesn't optimize the video feeds of its Binge On providers. Binge On, the idea is you get free, no bandwidth use viewing of Netflix and other stuff, not YouTube. Turns out what Binge On does is just takes any video stream. If you got to turn it on as a T-Mobile customer, it takes any video stream and just downgrades it to 1.5 megabits. Doesn't optimize it. If you're watching Twit and the server you're on isn't noticed that you're at a slower bandwidth, it'll pause, it'll hiccup, it'll freeze. It is throttling. Pure and simple. Now, you can turn it off by turning it off. That's why John Ledger says it's not throttling. You could turn it off. He said it's BS to complain about it. And he said, who is this EFF anyway?
Huh.
Wow.
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 So dumb. Oh, Ledger.
Oh, my. You know, I'm a T-Mobile customer. I love T-Mobile. I don't like zero rating. That's this thing that some of these companies do where they don't count against your bandwidth to watch Netflix or to listen to Google Music or Spotify. I don't like that. It's really anti-net neutrality. Customers love it, though, right? What's wrong with that? But it makes T-Mobile kind of the arbiter of what's successful and what's not. He says, well, anybody can join Binge On. It's not about that. It's T-Mobile slowing down all video to 1.5 megabits. And T-Mobile has confirmed that. Even if John Ledger says it's BS.
This is their free thing, right?
Yeah, the idea is if you are a T-Mobile customer and by default Binge On is turned on, you won't have to pay for bandwidth for Netflix. I can't really can't really play this because he's very angry and he swears a lot.
John, it includes a proprietary technology, and what the technology does is not only detect the video stream, but select the appropriate bit rate to optimize.
Not so. It turns all videos down to 1.5 megabits. The EFF was able to demonstrate that. It does no optimization. And I can't play part B of his answer, which is profane. Who are you, EFF? Why are you stirring out so much trouble? Who pays you? I pay them because I'm a donor, and a lot of other people pay the Electronic Frontier Foundation to call BS when they see BS. Yeah. Shame on you, T-Mobile. Shame on you, John Ledger. We know what you're up to. The big lie does not work. All right. I think we're done. We gotta go watch the Golden Globes.
Golden Globes.
Gotta go live, right. Snark.
Live snark time.
Live snark.
I'll be following you, Settern, S-E-T-T-E-R-N on Twitter. That's Serenity Caldwell. iMore.com. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for being
here.
Michael Nunez, now of Gizmodo. Can I say that?
Give me a week.
Currently, technology editor at Popular Science Magazine. He's Michael F. Nunez on the Twitter, and soon to be. What will your title be at Gizmodo?
Technology editor of Gizmodo.
Like it. That seems like a good job.
I'm excited about both. You know, PopSci has been great. Gizmodo will
love PopSci. It's a legend.
Yeah.
Congrats.
It's a phenomenal place to work. And there's no hard feelings here. I have a lot of friends that'll keep working there.
Where are you located? I never asked.
I'm based in Brooklyn. So that's what you're looking at here. Okay. And we work out of Manhattan.
Nice. And that'll be the same for Gizmodo?
Yes, correct.
Good. Of course, my good buddy Jason Heiner, who declared many, many moons ago the president of the internet. President for life, I might add, so don't ask
you
for another
elected.
Election.
It wasn't up to me. I just put you up, and the internet elected you, you know?
So. And then honored me with a chapter in Follow the Geeks, followthegeeksbooks.com. And, of course, Jason's editor-in-chief of Tech Republic. Thanks for being here, all three of you. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody who joined us. Yeah, what a great conversation.
Smart.
I love it when we get smart people together and we talk about important things. There's nothing better. That's what Twit's all about. If you can, watch live. We're 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time, 2300 UTC on Sunday afternoons. Or evening, depending on where you are. But you can always get on-demand versions after the fact at our website, twit.tv. But best to subscribe on Apple TV, on Roku. There's apps everywhere, Stitcher, Slacker, and iTunes everywhere. If you'd like to be in studio, we love having you. Great studio audience today. Just email tickets at twit.tv. We'll put a chair out for you, and we'll put a canned ham under each and every chair. Oh, gosh, we forgot this week. Sorry. Thanks for joining us. And we'll see y'all next week. Another Twit is in the can. Bye-bye, everybody.
Yay! Yay!